Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, it's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. Back in the rugby dungeon, as we have been for the last, guys, five in 1 week's time today, we'll have been podcasting for 10 years exactly.
And so 1 week today, that will start our 11th year.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. Our 11th year will start with a podcast about England and however they get on against Argentina.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because we need to talk about some other rugby. And that's what I intend to say this podcast.
Well, obviously, we are just days away from a Rugby World Cup right now, so that will definitely feature at some point on the podcast, despite JB's attempts to down the leagues.
There's three of us on this podcast. If it goes for an hour, I would suggest that we put 20 minutes into local rugby, because that's fair.
Well, okay.
40 minutes for you boys, 20 minutes for me.
All right. If we do that, if we aggregate over the 10 years, the percentage of...
And 5 minutes of Steve Diamond.
Yes, right, at least fine. 5 minutes Good. Of Steve Diamond.
And 2 minutes of Sam Burgess.
Exactly.
Oh. And everything leads back to Lancaster as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Always. Right. Wherever you get your podcast, hit subscribe. Thank you very much for listening. Go to patreon.com/eggchasers for more content and to help keep the lights on. Really appreciate your support there. And that's Phil.
Hello, Tim.
And that's a barefoot JB.
Hello, Tim.
OnlyFans ready.
Indeed.
How is that OnlyFans channel going?
Not as lucrative as your YouTube, unfortunately. I mean, I am trying, but it's just not going well. What, actually, whilst we're on it, you did all of your power rankings this week, so maybe we could hear a bit about them when you go through the teams.
Mm. Yeah, I could do with a little bit of help on a couple of those. There's a couple of positions are really hard to...
Which ones did you struggle with?
Outside centre.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Who would you have number one outside centre?
Gael Thicke? It comes to mind.
You've got Ringrose,
Thicke. Well, Am's not in the World Cup squad.
I know, but I'm still
Rico Ioane. Thicke.
But it does make you realise, just in that is, you talk about it a lot, Phil, that one of the most difficult positions, if not the most difficult position on the park to play. And that when it was a real struggle. So
Rico, I do really like Rico Ioane. I think it took a few years to settle down in the 13 jersey. He obviously plays there for the Blues as well, but he's now made that his own. And the centre partnership of him and Barrett.
Maybe a better question is, who's going to be the best 13 after the World Cup? Who's going to light it up? Because, you know, Caden Moody seems to have a few things to say about 13 jerseys.
Could he get a starting job? I'll tell you what, so let's go through pool by pool. It seems the most logical way to do this.
You mean the classic Brian Moore approach?
Oh, yeah, like Brian Moore did on The Telegraph. Except, should we try and put some flesh on the bones?
Try
and avoid cliches. We don't know what French team's going to turn.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we open up with the tired cliche, and then, you know, then we expand.
Okay.
Pool by pool, then. Pool A: New Zealand, France, Italy, Uruguay, Namibia. Now,
the lopsided draw has been talked about many times, so we don't need to labour the point. But you just feel a bit sorry for Italy in that context, don't you?
I really do, because I think this is the best Italy team we've seen for a long time, certainly for 10 years, and probably longer. They've got some really good quality operators, guys like Lamaro, guys like Garbisi, guys like the rugby pixie Capuozzo, yeah, but yeah. Like solid centre. Negri's absolutely enormous and hard as nails. Monte Ioane, JB's boy.
Lorenzo Cannoni, yeah. The number eight's really good. Danilo Fischetti's a really good loose end.
Well, here's
prop.
The thing, right? I have a little bit of an issue with this. We were speaking about it upstairs. But I think the World Cup is... I mean, it depends how you look at it. If you're looking at the World Cup kind of from the loser point of view, which is, let's just go as far as we can and hope for the best. Well, yeah, you want the best side of the draw, don't you? Because you want to say, yeah, we made the semi-finals, quarter-finals. That's not really what the World Cup's about. The World Cup is about winning it. So if you go to a World Cup, yeah, it's great. Namibia's never really going to win a World Cup. But that should be everyone's aspiration. And if you don't win it, everything else is a waste of time.
So I do agree with that. Although in the context of us talking about Italy, I think... They are kind of in the loser mindset. Italy to qualify from the group would be a big thing.
And I would say that South Africa, I think, were the... I don't know if they were the first... They may have been the first team at the last World Cup to lose a game, or certainly lose their opening game, to lose a game and go on and win the World Cup.
Yeah, I believe they're the first team to have done that.
So it's not uncommon for team. Well, it's now not uncommon for teams to lose a game in the pool stage and still go on and win a World Cup. So it's not just about winning every game. And it could well be, in the case of Pool B, which we'll come to, that every team finishes the pool with three wins.
Yep.
And one goes out on a head-to-head or a try score.
Which is exactly
what
happened to
Japan in 2015,
which is,
I think,
a really cruel way to go out, right?
It is, yeah.
So 2015 we went. Hold on.
No, 2015 they went out in that manner.
And again then?
No, because they got to the quarterfinals in 2019.
Yeah.
And they went out to South Africa?
They did. Yeah. Because they
beat Scotland, didn't they?
They beat Scotland and Ireland.
That's right. Yeah,
I think a more compelling thing to say in response to the lopsided draw is that it has made the pool stages so interesting. So many very, very significant games. And the quarterfinals are going to be unreal.
Because they are, the top five teams are on one side of the draw, which means pools A and pool B are dynamite, and then pools A and pool B meet each other. So you will have four of the top five teams playing each other in the quarterfinals, unless by some miracle Tonga or Italy or Uruguay cause an upset, which is highly, highly unlikely.
Well, okay, I'm not saying it's highly unlikely.
I am.
It's unlikely. I mean, it's unlikely that Uruguay are going to cause an upset.
It's highly unlikely.
So Uruguay are a good team.
Yeah. But okay, they're not going to cause it, and neither are Namibia, right?
Yeah.
Italy could.
Italy, however. I just think we need to bear this in mind. We're looking at an All Blacks team which are schizophrenic when it comes to their consistency. You're losing at home to Argentina sort of demonstrates that. Their biggest ever loss to South Africa demonstrates that. They're not the unbeatable team they once were. Now, are they going to win? 80-90% yes. But then Italy have also got a couple of wins under their belt against France.
They've beat France three times, not for 10 years, but the last time they played them, they only lost by 5 points this year.
Yeah.
And that's this incarnation of the French team.
So, and this is the first time as well they've got players, well, not the first time, but the first time in a long time, they've got players in key positions who are very, very good in top-flight clubs, mostly Garbisi. I mean, I think Garbisi might not start for France, but he'd certainly be in consideration. And same for the All Blacks, too. He is a genuine talent.
Yeah.
I mean, he's such a genuine talent. He plays for a team that only last year won the top 14. So, they've got a shot. If you've got a fly off who's that good, you've got a shot.
I agree. I think they've got a shot, but it is a long shot.
If you played
that game, so let's all, yeah.
If you went through this, if you had this pool 100 times, how many times do Italy come out of that pool out of 100 times?
I guess after like 100 games, they'd know their opposition fairly well.
it works both ways, I guess.
It evens itself out eventually.
I think it's one or two.
Or two out of 100, I agree with that. So it's a 1 or 2% chance of this happening. So I would not put any money on it. And I think I would describe that as highly unlikely.
Yes.
Okay. Just going back to your outside centre dilemma, Tim. Who's outside centre for Italy? He's a bit... Brex.
So there's Brex or Morisi.
Brex. Yeah. I like Brex a lot. He's a big, strong boy. Brex gain lines.
Yes.
He's very good defensively.
I just don't see him beating France or New Zealand.
Well, France, no Jonathan Dante. Does that change your mind?
For the first game.
Yeah, okay, so he's back for...
Italy play their two big games. So the way this pool breaks down, the matchups you need to look out for are obviously the opening match, France v New Zealand, with what a way to start a World Cup. And there's a lot of people thinking that this may be the bookend, that may be the first and the last fixture of the World Cup.
Yep.
Yeah.
Could happen. The other fixtures to watch out for are week 4 and week 5, when New Zealand play Italy, and then in week 5 when France play Italy.
Yeah, so Italy, they have got the teams in... ranking order, in my opinion. So they play Namibia first, who are the whipping boys. They then play Uruguay, and Uruguay are a good team.
Like, I think Sergio Arata, their scrum half, is mint. Genuinely a good scrum half.
Arata is a great player, as Charles Richardson knows. He's one of the few players who was mentioned on the Braemore Predictor podcast.
Yeah, he might be one of the only players mentioned.
He might have been the only player. Anyway,
Santiago Arata, I think his name is.
But they've also got this amazing... So, Chile and Uruguay have got this... what's the name of the Australian forward whose name we just mentioned upstairs?
Australian forward?
Australian forward who you did a podcast with.
Ben Darwin.
So, Uruguay and Chile have got this cohesion that is off the charts.
Yeah.
As a consequence of the Superliga Americas Rugby, or whatever it's called now... That basically post COVID and post Jaguares leaving Super Rugby proper, this South American club tournament was set up. And very predictably, the Jaguares, in the first year of it running, ran away with it. They won it comfortably. Argentina have then disbanded the Jaguares and formed two teams to spread their players, plus all the players, all the Argentine internationals who were playing for the Jaguares have moved all around the world. They're playing in Japan and in Europe and anywhere else. And what that has meant is two teams then have come to the fore, one being a Uruguayan team, Peñarol, who have won the two subsequent tournaments, and... The majority of the Uruguayan pack play for this team, so they've got an enormous cohesion. And the same thing happened with Chile, and it's Seltenham is the team there, and they got to the final the year before last. And again, the majority of the Chilean team play for this one team. So you're going to have, while they might not have quite the top-end talent... And they might not have the experience of playing in Europe, a lot of these guys, although some of them do, like Santiago Arata, who you mentioned before, Tim. Uruguay and Chile will have this enormous cohesion, which definitely counts for something.
Definitely. So,
go on, sorry.
How do you see the first match going? France, New Zealand. I mean, what a way to open up. But I'm going to contend the result doesn't really matter.
I think you're right, because whoever wins is playing whoever comes second in Pool B, and whoever comes second in Pool B is basically a coin toss. Like, it doesn't really matter. So it's not like you can say, oh yeah, we'll get an easier ride if we win this game and a harder ride if we come second.
I suppose you could say getting the French public on board day one would set them up
nicely,
really nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think what we're going to find in all these pools is there's usually going to be one big game with two of the major teams, and in one pool, three major teams. I would just say there's going to be an upset this World Cup, and it's going to be a massive one, because people are so focused on the other great rival, they've actually forgot about the improvements of all the others. Mm. Italy in this pool, and I guess if we're talking about Pool B next, it'd be Tonga.
Yeah, definitely. I do like the idea of... So I think New Zealand might win this first game. And I like the idea of then pressure being put on France in their last game, the last game of this pool, in... Where is that game being played?
In Paris. No, it's not in Paris, is it? It's...
Lyon.
Lyon, yeah.
So France versus Italy in Lyon on 6th of October to basically decide... Are France going to make it out of the pool?
I'd like that, because that's one of the games I'm slated to go to, so okay. I'd like there to be something on it. So
fantastic.
One of the things which is going to be massive in this, and I don't know if you watched the France-Australia game. Do you anyone see that?
Yes, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, so I was waxing lyrical about the performance of the fly half in the second half, who is, what's his name now?
Hastoy?
Nope, the other one.
Jalibert starts.
And I was like, he really opened up second half.
Mm.
That happens to correspond with the yellow card. So it looks to me, and I think this will be a theme, that teams have spent a lot of time working out how to defend with 14. And I wonder if there's going to be a change of mindset. Rather than how do you defend against 14, how do you defend with 14, how do you attack against 14?
Well, we saw that with Ireland against England, didn't we? As soon as England were down men, they went instantly coast to coast. Like, it's something they've practiced
many
times.
And that's exactly what we saw with France. Because when we watched it, I was like, bloody hell, I missed that. Completely missed it.
And it's very much a Leinster thing as well. Like, obviously, that flows into the Ireland team. But Leinster's strategy notably changes, particularly in the big game. They will take points when they're playing against 14 men. They'll take points when they're playing against 15 men. As soon as they're playing against 14 men, they will play riskier plays and they will turn down kickable kicks to kick for the corner.
So, just pulling all the strings, all the bits of a conspiracy theory together, we know that Australians and potentially Southern Hemisphere people in general do not take the tackle height rules too seriously after the Owen Farrell debacle. We also know that the...
Well, no. They don't take them seriously when it's an Englishman making the tackle. They take them very seriously when it's an Englishman taking the tackle.
No, they don't, because it's the Australians that let him off.
Oh, right, yeah.
Judicial.
Yeah, yeah. But the actual players and the culture.
Okay, right.
And then you combine that with the fact that the All Blacks love a good card now, and they can't get enough of them. Well, they're piling up cards. So if the All Blacks find themselves with a couple of yellow cards, expect France to go absolutely wild. And also, expect a bit of ref pressure as well. Who wants to give a yellow card to the home nation?
The breakdown in this one's going to be massive. And the way that the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere referees differ in how... I mean, John Kerwin described it as pedantic Matthew Carley. But it's
Matthew Carley.
Yeah.
Get used to it.
That is Matthew Carley. That's the point. And Southern Hemisphere refs, the number of times we'll watch like Ben O'Keefe and go, oh my God, and Jakob Pipe, like,
what
oh
is
my
that?
God, just letting the breakdown go, like people flying in all over the shot.
But then there's inconsistency because they'll fly in all over the shot for 10 breakdowns in a row and then all of a sudden a penalty appears. And you're like, hang on, have you just seen the last 10 breakdowns?
If John Kerwin, right, who is not a coach, is he? He's a pundit at the moment, right? But if John Kerwin is like, Matt Carley's really pedantic, and you know he's really pedantic. It's your job.
Yeah.
He's a pedantic ref.
100%.
Like, shut up. Like, shut up. Yeah. And the same, like, if you see, I don't know, Ben O'Keefe or whatever, you know, feel free to chance your hand.
So, just on the tackle height in the Southern Hemisphere, like, I know you're referring to the Australian judiciary.
Yes.
The panel that initially allowed Owen Farrell's appeal to be successful. I was listening to Ross Tucker talk today on Science of Sport podcast, and he actually said that Jacques Nienaber was one of the first people to properly engage with the technique around dropping the tackle height.
Really?
Yeah, he said he's a physiotherapist by trade.
Really? Training,
which I didn't know.
No, I didn't.
But he's apparently very, very hot on the mechanics. What? He's obviously hot on the mechanics, but he realises the risk of playing with 14 men. And so you might actually see, like, I would probably stereotypically, and showing my biases, inaccurately think that South Africa would be more at risk at that, but maybe they're not.
Well,
maybe
I would say, generally speaking, their defence has been brilliant.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they never seem to miss a tackle. And that's really interesting.
So it's something to watch out for, because I only heard that today, and I've not yet watched them back with that lens.
So Paul A, then France, even without Donty. For the first game, even without Willemse for the tournament. And
the tournament?
Yeah.
Well, he's out.
Paul Willemse's out.
How did this happen?
He's on the reserve list. He's injured. He's got quadricep tear.
Oh, for God's sakes.
So he's had some bad couple of years with injuries.
Cyril Bye's out of the first game.
Yeah.
It's just combinations. They're 9-10 combination. Their centre pairing. Their front row.
Yeah.
They've got so much depth. It's not going to be a huge problem.
Despite that, you just go Dupont, Penno, Aldrit.
Yeah, Fiku.
Marchand, Fiku.
Yeah, but, you know,
Ramos.
It's not even an individual. It's a position. The hookers. Just say the hookers.
Yeah.
The back row. They're just... I mean, I like the second row as well. They've just got so many of them.
Yeah.
Like, the hookers
I still think they're going to have too much for New Zealand.
I hope so.
I'm not sure they will for New Zealand. My prediction is New Zealand win the first time these two teams meet. France win the second time these two teams meet. That is genuinely my prediction for the tournament.
I think it's going to go really wrong for New Zealand really quick.
Mm.
I think that France punch them in the mouth and they don't stop punching them. That's what I think it is.
All right. So you two are both saying
France 2.
I'm saying France 1, New Zealand 2 in the pool, and you're saying New Zealand 1, France 2.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Whichever.
Paul B.
Yes. So it starts off, the teams are in reverse order. Romania, who are here to make up the numbers, unfortunately.
A cheat, probably.
Who knows? Tonga, then Scotland, then Ireland, then South Africa.
Just one very small point. We mentioned Namibia and now Romania as well, but there's Chile as well in Pool D. And it would be nice to have the format that the Sevens does. And we talked about this
before. Yeah.
Where there were midweek games. Because the games when you get to the knockout stages are only at weekends. It would be good to have a Thursday night game or a Friday night game that was a sort of undercard knockout. A plate or a
completely
whatever.
Agree. It'd
be great for Namibia and Romania. It would also be quite funny to see whichever team didn't get out of the pool, like whether that's England, Wales, or whatever.
But maybe
having to face the shame of going and playing against Chile and Romania.
England in 2015, we always back ourselves at home in the loser bowl.
I'd love to see Bill Sweeney spin that. So I think the danger in this pool is obvious, but the less obvious danger. I'm going to make a prediction. One of these big teams loses to Tonga.
Oh, I can't see it.
Why? They're so focused on each other.
Yeah, well, Tonga have... Yeah, I get that point. And Tonga have got some talent back in their ranks. Malachi Fakatoa and Charles Piatau.
Some.
And unfortunately, Izzy Falau is injured.
Is out. Yeah.
So they do have talent, but...
Sapawanga?
Samoa. But they are... The difference is, unlike Fiji, they are... still kind of just Adam Coleman's another one. They're just kind of thrown together a little bit and they don't have the cohesion that Phil's talking about.
We saw them last year. They did not look good, did they? They did not look great.
They really looked like...
Looked like talented players thrown together.
Yeah. However, they have had time.
They have.
And you know, they've got four games to have even more time together. Ireland, Scotland, South Africa have got two massive games. Like, it's unlike any other pool list. So the temptation to rest players against Tonga is going to be huge. Mm. And they're going to come unstuck. They are going to come. Someone will come
particularly
unstuck.
Particularly in the case of Ireland with their schedule, because they have Romania first. And because they've only had two warm-up games and Johnny Sexton hasn't played, you would imagine they go full strength for that match.
Mm.
Well, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll ease into it a little bit more still. But
yeah, and they've got a few guys carrying Knox who have not really... Like Sheehan, Conan... So, yeah, I don't think they'll go full strength.
Yeah, possibly not then.
So they'll ease into that. But then, Sexton has to play.
Yeah, Sexton has to play. And then week two, they have Tonga. And then after that, they've got their two big games.
Yep.
South Africa and then Scotland.
If they take their after ball for 1 second, Tonga will take advantage.
Yeah. And Ireland, they almost lost to Samoa a couple of weeks ago. So it's not impossible. I think they are alive to it. Like, you just have to look at the names on the team sheet to think, like,
bottlers. Okay, absolute bottlers.
This pool is all about matchups. And so the opening weekend, South Africa just got too much heat for Scotland. They just got too much heat, and I just don't like that matchup for Scotland. The matchup to end the pool, though, where Scotland play Ireland. I quite like that matchup from a Scottish perspective.
So do I. And I love South Africa against Ireland. I think Ireland will get absolutely battered by South Africa.
Oh, I see. I could see South Africa beating Scotland, Ireland beating South Africa, Scotland beating Ireland.
Yeah.
And then some sort of bonus point shenanigans.
Yeah.
And somebody doesn't get the bonus point against Tonga and runs very close.
Yeah.
Or Ireland get a losing bonus point against Tonga and that maybe gets them through.
A losing bonus? No, because if you lose against one of those teams, you're out.
Yeah, but Scotland also lose but without the bonus point.
Scotland, so Tonga. Yeah, yeah. Well, Tonga are going through. Tonga only lost to South Africa.
Brilliant. So, yes. I think Scotland and South Africa get out of this pool.
So, Scotland, I think, can be dangerous to South Africa as well. Like, I really do. We've seen them. So, Scotland's warm up game.
They're going to have to score 30 points.
Let me play through my logic. So, Scotland's warm-up games were France twice and Georgia, which is, and they might have had one other game, but those are the key ones, which is, those are the games you want when you're preparing for South Africa.
Yeah.
And they stood up their pack, even when they had to rotate because Xander Ferguson was suspended. Their pack stood up to that test, and even they were dominating a very, very strong Georgia pack whose props are all earning hundreds of thousands of euros a year playing for the top teams, playing for Toulon and La Rochelle and Racing 92. So I don't think that's... They're not going to be totally blown away by South Africa up front. And South Africa, if we just ignore last week where they totally dismantled New Zealand, and a few weeks before that when they totally dismantled Wales, generally in knockout rugby, they don't actually score that many points. They keep it quite close. They keep it more of an arm wrestle. And if Scotland are in the game, they've got the players to be able to score 14, 21 points in 20 minutes when things click. So I think Scotland can.
Doohan up against South Africa is just... Doohan and Pierre Schoeman up against
South Africa.
And WP Nell.
And Kyle Steyn.
It's a bit ridiculous, isn't it? When you look at the Scottish team, it's a bit ridiculous.
So you think that they're going to have to score about 30 points to win this?
Yeah.
A bit like Bishop's Castle and Onny Valley this weekend.
There you go, that's 10 seconds of your quota.
Who allegedly lost to Upton-on-Severn 34-100. We don't know the truth of that yet.
Yeah. It's a hell of a scoreline.
Yeah. It is a hell of a scoreline.
We'll give you 34 points. Do you think you can win?
Yes,
absolutely.
I'll take 34 points.
And you're not getting losing bonus points. Oh, we missed a
one. Yes.
With Paul B, again, I hope there's something significant riding on the last game, just as a pure neutral, Ireland v Scotland.
Well, there will be, I'm sure.
Well, there will be for quarter-final spots, if nothing else. But which two are coming out of this pool, Phil, for you?
Oh, I change my mind every time I look at this. I think it is South Africa and Ireland.
In that order?
Maybe the other way around. Ireland, South Africa.
South Africa and Scotland.
But I think Scotland really can disrupt anyone.
Yeah.
Like I don't think Scotland can win the tournament just because I don't think they can win the number of games on the bounce. But I could easily see them. I could even see a way to Scotland topping this pool. But I think most likely is Ireland first, South Africa second.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Just a couple of things before we leave this pool. Firstly, the odd, really bizarre freak out that was Matt Williams that...
Oh, I heard this!
Like, having to go saying this... 7-1. 7-1. Having a moan about the 7-1 split.
Because it's for safety or something.
Well, he said that we didn't used to have substitutions. Then we got brought them in because of... And Keith Wood was also saying we need to change the way they do the substitutions off the back of South Africa bringing on all seven forwards at once at Twickenham. I think there's an element of... South Africa have got so much depth that, as we've already said, WP Nell, Pierre Schoeman, and the list goes on and on and on, like Paul Willems are obviously not involved. And you go around the world and they've other international packs are stacked with South Africans and they've got enough quality they can bring seven brilliant players off the bench all at the same time. I think that's all this is. It's actually just envy.
I tend to agree.
I think it's a little bit more than that. I think it's kind of like a misguided intelligence, almost. So they're trying to make a point which actually doesn't stack up. So the point would be that it's unsafe because you don't have a replacement back, your backs need to be replaced, or I guess that's the point, right? But if you think about it, it's the forwards that take the majority of the hits. Like, this isn't
it's the way South Africa play as well. They're just leaning into their strength.
Yeah, but you're replacing...
Which is fine.
What I'm saying is you're replacing a part of your team which gets more wear and tear with... another player.
Well, I don't think safety came up in the...
It did. It was a key pillar of what he said. Literally, he said that. He said, we've done this for years, and it's for safety and it's for welfare. That's what he said.
I don't see a problem with it, because it's... like.
So I don't see a problem with it. That's why I'm saying this.
Agreed. 4 years ago, South Africa pioneered the 6-2 split.
I mean, I don't know why you just don't go... If you've got enough talent, just go with 8 forwards, particularly if you've got lads that can do a job in the backfield.
Yeah, well, the other way to look at this is no one would have been complaining and people would have been saying, what a naive thing to do, how stupid, had South Africa got a couple of back injuries.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, everything comes with trade-offs.
Yeah.
So no solutions, only trade-offs.
Yeah.
So unless you've got someone like McAloo in your squad.
McAloo's a great example. Yeah. But if you go, like, even with a 6-2 split, you lose two or you lose three backs.
Yeah.
And then you've got a problem.
Well, I mean, you look at it in two ways, don't you? You either look at backs and forwards, which is traditional. We look at it as skill players and non-skill players, in which case you can have as many non-skill players as you want, except for maybe one.
Or pace players and non-pace. Like, a pace player who can play, like McAloo can play in the outside channels because he's fast.
But, like, say if you've got a 9, a 10, and a 15 that are interchangeable, 9, 10, or 12, which are interchangeable, there's no reason why you just don't go with 8 forwards. Point, or 8 non-skill players.
Do you know what?
I've got a quote from Matt Williams here.
Yes.
It's ridiculous, please.
World Rugby should act in the next week and say, during the World Cup, you need 3 recognised backs on your bench.
Problem over.
The fact that they haven't, South Africa are not breaking any rules. It's just nuts.
That is nuts.
It's absolutely...
He's had 4 years to complain about a 6-2 split, and now... And this is the thing, what I was just about to say was, it is absolutely ridiculous to have this conversation 2 weeks from a World Cup. And the Kiwis were at it as well with the whole TMO bunker thing, which they didn't complain about until now. And then all of a sudden, after the Twickenham match, there was a massive meltdown about the TMO bunker and officiating in general.
I've been complaining about Owen Farrell's lack of standards for years. Am I okay to continue this because it wasn't in vogue when he got sent off? Or before he got sent off.
You can continue doing whatever you want.
Yeah, but the pundits can't.
What do you mean?
Because they only started after he got sent off.
No, what I'm saying is...
Do I have permission to go Owen Farrell continuously now? Because I've done it for a long time.
What I'm saying is 2 weeks out from a World Cup, like, let's focus on the rugby. Like, just leave any of these conversations. Nothing's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. Give over.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair point. Do you know what, though? I do quite like the drama. Like, I do and I don't. Like, I do enjoy that Matt Williams is... Because it's so stupid as well. It's so stupid.
I guess, like, you can say whatever you want. Free to say whatever you want. And we can say that is a stupid thing to say.
It is stupid. But, you know, how many hours of TV time and debate and pub chat and everything else does the VAR in football generate? Like, sometimes... I kind of get it because I remember... back to Owen Farrell, actually... Like, that was just a absolute train wreck for rugby because it made us look stupid. But, you know, something like this, I think, is probably a worthwhile discussion because it's a genuine innovation. I mean, it's not groundbreaking. You didn't need to be a genius to think about it, but it is an innovation to see it happen.
All I would say is, like, choose your moments and choose your times. I suppose Matt Williams, you could argue, is was talking from an impartial point of view in that case.
Yeah, and to defend Matt Williams, why would he be whinging about a 7-1 split before it happened? You know, it has to happen.
But he's saying it should be 5-3, and he's complaining about 6-2.
He's now calling 6-2 to be banned.
That is fair.
I mean, he might have been calling this to be banned for years, but now someone's finally listened to him.
What have you played?
What I would say is when your team loses, it was great for business on my YouTube channel. 150,000 views.
That's
in a couple
main
of days.
Thing.
And I got 100,000 views in a day doing a little video, just taking the mickey out of basically New Zealand's rugby show going on and on and on about bunker officiating rather than just doing anything except talking about the rugby on the field and the areas that New Zealand needs.
Is this because they lost and it was all because
of
the bunker?
That's my point. So pick your moment.
You.
It looks, even if you may have a point, as you say, maybe there is something that's worth discussion. Maybe just choose when and how you raise that point, because when you lose a game, going on about refs and stuff just looks salty.
Yeah, so you'd be very happy if the South Africans were whinging about the bunker after a massive victory.
It would carry more weight with me, yeah.
And in the Lions, if Razzie had pointed out all the times that his team were off their feet and not competing at the breakdown and coming in at the side alongside the Lions, it would have had a lot more weight to it.
Yeah. Mm.
Agreed.
There we go. Excellent. So, you both think it's Ireland and South Africa?
I do, unfortunately, for Scotland.
Interesting.
Paul C. Now, I think, as much as Paul B is a pall of death, this is a pall of death.
Well, this could be, I think, one of four could qualify in this.
Yeah, I agree.
Georgia have not got an enormous hope. But they have a shot.
A few players, Gorgadza, the number 8, is excellent. Yep. Aprazidza, the scrum half, is brilliant. Nini Ashvili, the fullback, is ace.
Nene Ashvili really is a quality operator.
And yes, as you've already mentioned, Phil, they have more. They have enough props to furnish every team in the world's front row. But,
yeah.
they're much more than just a tight five scrummaging, mauling team. They've got a lot more in their locker than that now.
They are now, because as well as Nene Ashvili, they've also got Tabu Zadza, who is, I think he's on 26 tries in 26 games as a winger, which is not a bad record.
It's all right.
So they can do a little bit more than they just traditionally would do, which was a forward orientated set piece power game. So they could, and the fact that they are strong. They're a strong Georgian team. They match up quite nicely with the other teams around them. So Fiji, traditionally totally opposite to Georgia, although anyone who's watched them in the Pacific Nations Cup or their more recent games will know that they have done a lot of work on their set piece and on their power game and on their ability to control the game, with Caleb Muntz both having the ability to control field position and, as we saw at Twickenham, keep the scoreboard ticking over.
And there's players in that Fijian team that weren't involved at Twickenham. Joshua Tuisova.
If he can get fit, because he's been injured.
Then, how do you pick your centres then?
Well, centres or back row or wing. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. How would Matt Williamson play him on the bench?
And Lavani Bottia, is he allowed to play in the backs?
Got no idea. Ask Matt Williamson.
Yeah. Could he be part of a 7-1 split?
Does he need a certificate from some pundits?
Yeah.
You got your backs licence. Well done.
Yeah, well done. what licence would Matt Williamson have given Sam Burgess?
Oh, that's a great question.
Isn't it?
Ooh. He never really should have played anywhere outside.
What would be the back equivalent of reverse park, emergency stop? What would you have to pass to get a backs licence?
Well, hang on. I mean, there's been some genuinely awful backs.
You'd have to run a good overs and unders line.
Yeah,
hang on a minute.
Basic. That's
Hang on a minute. So I'm just thinking, like,
that's like the cockpit check.
The truck and trailer drill.
You would say
with the
this,
four
right?
corners, yeah. And you run around.
And I completely agree with you on paper, but I just don't see lads like what's his name from Wales, Cuthbert, actually passing these tests. And he was a lion. Matt Williamson is the NFL pundit. Yeah. Matt Williams couldn't in good conscience issue his licence.
It's like I heard rumours of I think it's the old concussion test where you had to set a baseline of players who couldn't get a passing baseline score. The test deemed them as concussed in their normal operating. It's a Tuesday. Tuesday in pre-season, they've not played for months.
I was at a barbecue last night with a girl who works for a psychologist, and the psychologist's job is to work out who is lying after car crashes as to how bad their memory loss is. And they said that some of these people are failing their tests on purpose so badly that it's early onset dementia. And this is what
they're faking. Yeah.
So like, this is how, and they have to separate the memories into like long term and short term because they function differently and all the rest of it.
Well, even people that aren't trying to obfuscate, memory's really unreliable anyway, isn't it?
Well,
it's given such massive weight in court cases and stuff, but
I did mention, going down the rabbit hole here, have you heard of the replication crisis in psychology? Which is...
And in a lot of...
Do you know what the replication crisis is?
Go on, no.
Oh, I'll tell you this once, but then you've got to pack it up and then just look at it in your own time, because you'll spend hours on this. It is basically, most of academia is absolutely trash because they can't replicate the findings in papers.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, 100, yeah.
It's all nonsense. But they're experts. They're absolutely experts.
They're experts.
It's definitely not just psychology as well.
Concussion?
That's not psychology.
It's across the whole thing.
It's mostly in psychology.
And quite often...
No, it's in like...
Oh, yeah.
In lots of other scientific...
Follow the money.
Yep, quite. Yeah.
Like you don't get your grants and you don't get your funding unless you come to the conclusion that the people paying you want you to come to.
Exactly. Well, we can talk about people grifting for money later, actually, with Progressive Rugby. But let's carry on with the World Cup.
Yeah, because this pool is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Because Fiji, we've just talking about, they've got a legit shot at not just getting out the pool, but topping the pool.
Well, Wales also...
Yeah, they could do.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what? Yes. Yeah. Just yes. Wales announced their co-captains this week. So Demi Lake and Jack Morgan are co-captains. Which I think it's
the first time. They announced that when he announced the squad a couple of weeks ago.
I thought he announced that this week, officially.
Or maybe officially, but they were down as co-captains when he announced the squad. But anyway,
it doesn't really matter.
Doesn't really matter.
That's all. Is that the first time an international team has had co-captains? I've seen Bath do it, but that's not a blueprint for success.
Don't know.
I don't think it's that bad.
I don't think it's bad or good, really. But
it kind of speaks to where Wales are at. He doesn't know exactly who his 15 is. I hope he does now.
Well, it kind of tells me
he does know who he's going to be playing this weekend against Fiji.
Yeah, Fiji turn over Wales, you know, the world is their oyster. This is their big game. So Fiji do this and they're basically through. I'd love to see him.
I don't know. I think Phil's right. Georgia match up well against Fiji.
Yeah. No, I can see Fiji topping the group. I can see them beating. They can beat Australia. They can beat Georgia. They can beat Wales. And they can beat Portugal.
I think this is maybe the most likely pool where everyone suffers at least one defeat.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I could see Wales beating Australia in a one-off. I could see Fiji beating Wales in a one-off. And I could see Fiji losing to Georgia.
I do think Australia are the favourite in my mind for this pool, even though they've got such a young team.
I agree with you.
I can't tell you how this Georgia team stacks up compared to past Georgia teams. I just don't know. I don't know enough on them. I do know this Fiji team is probably the best we've seen in a long, long time. And I know nothing. I know less about Portugal than Brian Moore does.
Well, we went to Portugal, but
Vladimir ruined
thanks
it.
Thanks to Vladimir Putin, we didn't actually get to see them play because they just played Russia.
Well, I mean, some people would blame Zelensky for that. Someone's spoiled our weekend.
They got a couple of good backs, haven't they? Is it not Pinto? I want to say.
Sounds like Pinto. I wouldn't be
surprised. They've got Betancourt, who plays at Oyonnax.
Yeah.
Who else have they got?
Winger, we're beginning with a P.
Zhao something?
And they've got
Vincent
Pinto. See, I was right, Pinto. And Marta's a decent centre.
But ultimately, what I'm trying to say is we're looking at one of the best Fiji teams in generations and probably two of the worst Australia and Wales teams in generations.
Yes.
So this is
agree with that.
Very spicy.
I love it.
Yeah.
And you know, for all the criticism about the pool, and if I was Scottish or Irish or South African or New Zealand, I would be a bit wounded by it. But how good is this pool?
Genuinely, it could be one of those four teams.
And it wouldn't be nearly as interesting if World Rugby had done the poll, done the draw 6 months ago. It wouldn't be nearly as interesting.
Interestingly on this, obviously Fiji have beaten Wales before and got to a semi-final. And it just shows that, I was going to say that Australia and Wales are in a very privileged position, which is no matter how bad they are, they could always rely on
Fiji get to a semi?
Quarter. But they had to go through a tier one nation to do so in one of the best games of all times.
2007.
Yeah.
That was an amazing,
unreal game.
That was France, wasn't it?
Yeah.
History's going to repeat itself.
But by the way, in terms of France, a lot of the Fijian team, in fact, here's a stat: 1 in 5 players at the Rugby World Cup play in France.
Wow. And there are certain.
Wow, good.
Yeah. There are certain teams who will have very, very few.
By the way, 1 in 5 players in the World Cup play in France, and that is with huge restrictions on player movement. Just remember that.
With the JIF in France and with certain teams, namely England, Ireland and
Australia.
New Zealand.
Those
having nobody outside their teams, and then certain other teams like Australia who only have 3, is it?
Yeah.
So a massive number of the Pacific Island nations.
If rugby markets, player markets were to be liberated, which is exactly what should happen, I think what you'd find is it'd probably be 1 in 3.
Yeah, but liberated, because you would have to take the handbrake off the national teams, but that would probably push the French Federation to put the handbrake on JIF even more.
Well, I think you're seeing a running battle, as I said last week, between World Rugby and the nations. I think this just shifts the power dynamics. So then the top 14 becomes almost overnight the most powerful, if it's not already the most powerful rugby entity in the world. It is definitely the most powerful rugby entity in the world. And what everyone seems to forget is if they're really interested in quote-unquote growing the game, It's not through pointless slogans or saying we need to include women or whatnot. It's by getting more people to watch. And I tell you what,
it's also,
an exciting top 14 would do that.
Well, yeah, and it's also when you look at... It's not just about the top 14, though. In terms of growing the game, France has steadily, over the last decade, increased the number of professional leagues. And to the point it now has four. Mm. Four fully professional leagues.
Sure, it's not three.
Well, it's now four.
Mm.
Only a few years ago, they introduced the third. Now, Federal 2 is fully professional.
Fully wow. professional.
And this is... So my point being that this is, in terms of growing the game, this may be, and I've been bloody banging this drum for years, but this might be a little... I'm not saying England should do it exactly like France. They shouldn't. No, like, just like Wales shouldn't have tried to do it exactly like Ireland, and it's blown up in their face. It needs to be specific for that nation, but... I don't buy the ring fence premiership. I don't think a 10-team franchise league is going to be good long term. And I think the French national team is going to go from strength to strength because of the structure they've got. And
how I think the top 14 it is the future. It's the only hope, really. It's not just the future, it's the only hope.
I think there's a good shout to say that Pro D2 will be as good a standard as the English Premiership.
In the next few years. Do you know what? Not only are you right, I think you're right within 3 years. I mean, I don't see how you're wrong, actually. Because already they are sucking in players who would be solid Premiership starters, and that's now. Like, right now. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense.
And it makes sense because the teams in Pro D2 can aspire to play in the top 14.
There's lots of reasons why.
Yeah, that is a reason why.
But is it also because the RFU are useless? The Premiership are useless. Well, they've sold everything to CBC. They're dying by 1,000 cuts.
But RFU couldn't control Premiership rugby signing up with CBC and.
Oh, they could. They could have vetoed it. They could have vetoed it.
The RFU could have vetoed 100%. Premiership rugby owners 100%. Selling 27% of their stake.
Yep. They could do that. Because they're the regulator of the game.
And what would you be saying if the RFU stepped in and told the owners of Premiership clubs, you're not allowed to do the thing that you all want to do?
I would say that they've got to sort it out between themselves. I'd like to see the owners do this ages ago, which is separate from the RFU. But you need a governing body. So, yeah, the RFU could have said no. 100%.
But there is another... interesting difference between France and England. France is 20% bigger than England, and football in England is much, much bigger.
Particularly in the south of France, where most of the rugby is. The southern half.
Yeah, but I did some numbers. I looked at some numbers a few years ago, pre-COVID, comparing the top flight of football, or top few flights of football in France to England, and England gets way, way more eyeballs actually watching games, like multiples of the number in France, whereas rugby, it's multiples in France more than rugby in England.
Yeah.
So you have this population which is one way in favour, but the preference for sport is massively stacked against England.
I would love to know how French pundits and French rugby writers cover the game in France. Do they do what the English do, which is it's about values and it's family, or do they talk about brutality and honour? And I don't know, because I don't understand French, but I'd love to know how they talk about the game, because I wouldn't be surprised if it's very, very different. Very different. And I don't know if you boys saw the message that was sent to our group, but we've had a message. It's an email from the WRU, the Welsh Union, to clubs suggesting how they engage more with communities to drive participation. And it's things like create a period positive clubhouse, create a the best one was a menopause positive clubhouse. Now, I'm all okay, great, but it's about as relevant to growing the game as, say, making your old people's home friendly for skateboarders.
Yeah,
like,
the point. There's nothing wrong with those suggestions. And
well, the opportunity cost is massive, isn't
it? Well, no.
You're wasting your time.
Hold on. Let me make a point. There's nothing wrong with those things. are you taking care of the fundamentals? It's a bit like when you talk about coaching a team. It's like, run all the, you know.
Today we're doing triple miss passes.
The triple miss passes, yeah, yeah. How's your line out more?
Yeah, exactly. It's just
can your players pass?
But you think, like, if this is what WRU are doing, and they've created little video, little videos for each, and little courses for each. I mean, it's all well and good, but you know, it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Well, on to Wales then, and back to Pool C. Like, do you, in that opening game, and we're less than a week away now, this time next week we will know the result of Wales v Fiji. What do you think? How do you think that one is going to go?
Give me Fiji.
I hope it's Fiji. I desperately hope Fiji win this.
I can really see it.
I can see it. I mean, I can see Wales winning. I think Fiji, when you look at, yeah. Neathalevu and Randrandra in the centre.
Or Neathalevu and, yeah, Tuisova.
Yeah, and then Ravatumada on the wing, and oh man, they've got, and Bottia back in. Oh, they got some talent. If they can do that, if they can do the job up front, then I'm going for a Fiji win.
Tuisova is one of those guys that kind of like Kyle Eastman. I used to ask people who's the best player you've ever played with. Anyone who played with Kyle Eastman would say Kyle Eastman. And if they didn't, and they go, what about Kyle Eastman? Like, oh yeah, yeah, Kyle Eastman.
Yeah.
They just need to be reminded of the guy. Tuisova, everyone that's played with him that I know and I've interviewed is that he is unbelievable.
He is. Such an unbelievable specimen.
Yeah,
because he's so enormous, but he's so powerful. He's so enormous. He's not that tall. He's just like this ball, low center of gravity, just ball of muscle.
Yeah, yeah. The number one scary thing in rugby is having your line broken and having it broken continuously. And Fiji, you've got. Do you know what Fiji might be able to do that better than almost anybody? And certainly in a unique way. So I guess South Africa can do it, and France can do it with just brute strength. But no one can do it with the power and the finesse of Fiji, and that is dangerous.
Mm.
So I'm saying, give me Fiji to beat Wales.
But Australia to beat Fiji.
Yes.
Which would mean that the third fixture it could be critical, Australia playing Wales.
I think Australia beat Wales.
I do as well. I think Australia top this group, actually. I think he could go either way,
but there is a certain
if Carter Gordon can actually kick sticks and get some points.
Is that the weekend? Are you coming to Leon?
Are we coming to Leon?
I don't know.
Maybe not.
So, you were toying with the idea on that weekend, weren't you?
So I don't know if history matters that much, but obviously the history between Wales and Fiji, it just makes Fiji slight favourites, and also Wales. The best one in the world, you can watch as much video as you want. They're just not going to be prepared as much as they would like for Fiji, because there's nothing in the Northern Hemisphere which prepares you for it. Australia, on the other hand, they do have the advantage on Wales and have done historically, but against Fiji, they know kind of what they're up against. They know far better than Wales.
Yeah, because a big chunk of this Fiji team, maybe not the key stars that we've mentioned, like Bottia, like Tuisova, like Radrandra, like Neathalevu, but a key part of the team play for the Fijian Drua, who have played against all of the Australian boys. Oh,
Tim?
I just need to take a call from my daughter.
Oh.
Hello.
Ooh.
It's usually from his agent at this time.
or he's the captain of his yacht.
Yeah, crikey. Cocker Force One.
So I am saying Australia first and Fiji second in this pool.
Australia first.
Fiji second. Wales third. Georgia, sadly, fourth.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
And then... So, Tim, just all okay?
Yeah, she was trying to blag a lift.
Oh.
why didn't you send your driver? Oh, is he busy? Is he on a break?
He's just getting the boat ready.
Right. Stacks up.
So... Tim, I'm saying Australia to top the pool.
Yes.
Fiji second.
I tend to agree, but I could totally see Wales beating Fiji, but how good is this pool? How good is this pool?
This pool is dynamite.
It is, isn't it?
And then on to Pool D.
Which is also dynamite, particularly with... There's been a lot to criticise World Rugby with, and I would continue to criticise the constant tinkering, the changing of laws. Don't like that. However... Their change of allowing players to go back to their country of birth.
Yeah, all grandparents. Parents and grandparents, yeah.
But, yes, I love it. And in the case of Samoa, what was the one? Jean Klein wasn't kind of the one that was designed to help.
Correct.
I don't mind it, but I love it for Samoa, who have Lima Sopawanga, genuine threat at 10.
And Christian Lealofano. Jordan Tafua, Stephen Luatua. They have Charlie Faumoina.
Some mega players there.
Great players. And now he's back fit again. Just, I know it's not the same ring. He was playing for Samoa all the time, but I'm so excited to see Theo McFarland.
Yes. Yeah.
What a baller.
They've got, because, like, Big Bad Brian.
Alan Luisi.
Yeah. Theo McFarland, Chris Vui.
Jesus, that's
Fritz Lee.
Hack and a half at.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them are aging, but you know, I don't think age is that much of a big deal in rugby nowadays. In fact, if anything, it just gives you a little bit more experience. And there's also an element of, like, I don't know what it is about Pacific Island players, but they seem to go on forever and not break. Like, do you remember the proper player for Cardiff?
Yes.
What was he, 48 by the time he retired and still bench press 200 kilograms?
Yeah.
You know, I was playing against the captain of... Well, he wasn't Catty. He played for, like, who was it? Catty at. His name is Catty, and he played at New Brighton until, like, recently. They just never stop. They never stop.
Until he's almost 50. Yeah, there is some serious talent in this team.
And experience. I mean, that's the thing which gets me most excited about the Pacific Islanders. It's, they've already got the talent. You can showcase it now with some real experience, some real guidance and wisdom. That is exciting. I mean, imagine getting to play. Imagine Luatua just walking into camp with all his All Black caps, with all of his, you know, experience with nearly winning stuff with Bristol.
Yeah. I mean,
it's bloody impressive.
Yeah.
Bloody impressive. So there's Argentina, there's England, we know about them. Chile, who knows anything about Chile?
Well, I mentioned it before that the Super Liga Americas rugby.
Yeah.
The Uruguay and Chile are benefiting from this. And just looking at the Chilean squad, of the 33, only 5 players do not play for Cheltenham. So 28 of the team play for Cheltenham, who reached the final, loss to the Uruguayan team year before last.
So
they've got some cohesion there. They lost to Peñarol, the Uruguayan team.
So Chile, I think, I need to check this out, but I'm pretty sure Chile have a coach who I don't know as such, but I've observed him very closely, and I've got to say, I was really impressed.
So that, go on. The main coach is a big fat Chilean bloke with a silver, big silver beard.
Not him.
Looks like Father Christmas.
Definitely not him.
Okay.
It is a guy called Dan Richmond, who coached at Sale Sharks. I was kind of unheralded. No one knew really who he was. But when I went down to Sale for the press days, I was lucky enough to actually stand on... This is like in the days when Dimes was in charge and did whatever you want, really. But you got to stand right next to the coaching stations. And he has some of the most unusual drills, but some of the most well-planned drills I've ever seen. Really inventive coach. So he then left Sale. I think he probably was a bit scapegoated. Do you know when Sale did that thing where they'd get to fifth unexpectedly, get to Europe, and then immediately nearly get relegated to South Europe? And I think they were on the down cycle of that.
Yeah, they did that about 3 times, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think he got caught up in but I really rated his work. And then he was at Cambridge and also at Chile. So that's quite I don't think it's going to make a shred of difference, but he's a very good coach.
Well, do you remember the only other bit that I know about Chile? Is, do you remember how they qualified?
USA,
yeah.
They had a 2-legged game against USA. One of the games, I think the first leg in the USA was in torrential conditions. And their fly half, Rodrigo Fernandez, scored a wonder try from inside his own half. Beat about 5 players. And I think they might have even lost the first one very narrowly and won the second one.
It was by 1 point.
Yeah, I think both. In one game was by 1 point, and one game was 2 or 3 points.
Yeah, I remember something like that.
It's an absolute amazing battle against.
What does Brian Moore think about Chile? Do we know?
I'm not
Tim.
Sure.
What's that? Sorry.
Do you know what Brian Moore thinks about Chile? Do we recall his thoughts on it?
I'm not sure he got into too much detail. No. I'm sure Charles Richardson would have a lot more detail than any of us on Chile, but sadly
that is fair.
He didn't get to put it out there.
No, he didn't. So,
So the other half of this pool.
England, Argentina, I think at this point is just a sheer toss-up. I think it's a 50-50 coin flip.
I think Argentina are favourites.
Maybe marginally. I just think that England seems to have the rub on Argentina.
Lost last year when we were in Malaga Airport.
Did they?
Do you not remember?
No, I don't.
We were watching it from a bar in Malaga Airport.
I remember being in the bar in Malaga Airport. I just don't
when
remember.
When you had a copious amount of Iberian ham.
That was Madrid Airport. Last year.
We'll talk about
I had too much, just marginally too much Iberian ham, Iberico ham.
Yeah, it was dreadful.
It can happen to any of us.
I think Argentina and Samoa exit the group. More hope than knowledge, but why not?
So I think Argentina will beat England. I think then England will be, with relative comfort, Japan and Samoa.
And the last game of the pool, is Argentina-Japan, which is going to be kind of inconsequential, really. England-Samoa on the Saturday, the 7th.
What I love about this World Cup is the amount of frayed nerves. There's going to be so many frayed
that game, because England will hopefully have beaten Japan, probably have lost to Argentina going into that game, and you could see it being... With the pressure coming on them, just failing to perform.
Yeah. Or, by that point, Owen Farrell will be back and available. He'll have already played against Chile. And here's me with my prediction, not just predicting a result, predicting a resounding win for England against Samoa to get him into the quarterfinals with George Ford at 10 and Owen Farrell at 12.
Yeah,
I've been saying it for months.
I could see that.
Ford Farrell's not done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're looking at. I mean, they could be successful against a tier 2 team, sure.
Manu Tuilagi will be injured by then.
Yeah, I mean, why he's even going is beyond me. God. So, I heard a theory the other day about why England have persevered with this team and not just torn it up. And one of the theories is because of the side of the draw that they're in. So, Eddie Jones is like, yeah, I'll just rip it up and start again because, you know, I've got the power... Yeah, I've got the contract. No one's going to stop me. They're not going to fire me, are they, after like 3 games because I've just got a load of kids in. So I'll just go wild. I'll do whatever I want. Steve Borthwick, not only is a good soldier, but I think he's looked at the drawing on. Christ, if I rip up this team now and put in a load of kids and then we go out in the group stages or the quarterfinals, that is criminal because actually we could get to a semi-final here.
Yeah, semi-final is the lowest that they should be expecting.
I agree with the second part, I can see what you're saying with the second part. The first part, that Eddie Jones was ready to rip it up, I saw no evidence whatsoever of that.
Go on.
Well, he didn't. He had, since the last World Cup, he didn't.
For England, are you talking?
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about Australia.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, so in Australia, he's like, Hooper can stay at home, Cooper can stay at home. Like, he's got rid of absolute worldies.
I suppose the reason that I would... The element that I would say that the evidence doesn't point to that is that Eddie Jones didn't do that after the last World Cup.
Immediately after Stuart Lancaster, didn't he? So, you know,
not really.
Stuart
Lancaster was the one that did all the changes. Stuart Lancaster was the one that did what Eddie Jones has done with Australia, England.
The big statement
he did.
Moves were Hartley to captain.
Hartley to captain.
I mean, that was a huge statement.
But Hartley had been in Lancaster's squad.
He'd been in Lancaster's. Lancaster was the one that brought in Henry Slade and...
Itoji came into the squad. Although I don't think he played
for
Lancaster.
Itoji never played for Lancaster.
No, he came into the squad.
I'm not sure the squad.
George Cruz played for Lancaster.
Don't know.
I'm pretty sure he didn't. You know, and that was like the foundation
of
that team.
Stuart Lancaster was the one that completely refreshed the England squad, which then went
rightly
on in 2019.
So. Yeah,
which then went on in to get to the World Cup final 4 years later. Or 5 years later, as it was then.
Kind of.
Yeah, he did. It's just a fact, mate.
It's just a fact.
It's just a fact. That's what happened. The personnel that got England to a World Cup final, the younger... element of it were the ones that Stuart Lancaster brought in after. Did Stuart Lancaster come in after Martin Johnson?
Yeah, 2012.
He was the one that pruned the deadwood and made the changes, much like Eddie Jones is doing with Australia now.
Well, I mean, so the reason I kind of disagree with that is that there are a lot of young talent. There's a lot of young talent coming through, but they didn't get in. One of the reasons that they didn't get in is because Stuart Lancaster was obsessed with hitting this cap target.
The evidence that it's why it is what happened is that in 2019 World Cup final, England had the youngest ever team to get to a World Cup final.
But they also had a load of caps in that team.
And you might argue that they're young because they finally got their chance, you know, over the intervening, like Australia are now, like sort of reinventing themselves. That's how I would look at it. Now, I'm not saying Lancaster wasn't up for playing the youth, but when Lancaster left, he was playing centre combinations like 12 Trees and Barrett and Luther Burrell, who were never seen ever again. And like you think about who his captain was, Robshaw, who was immediately de-captained. And
but still went on to play for several years.
Yeah, still did fine, but didn't make the World Cup squad. Same with Haskell. You know, so there is definitely some merit in what you're saying, but I just don't see it as like this linear, here are all the young players, which, and then of course the whole foundation was Itoje and Cruz.
Well,
do you know, so
changing his captain, but and maybe the odd bit of personnel, but generally speaking,
he didn't rip it up and start again.
No, he didn't. He absolutely didn't.
I've got the, do you remember the England tour to Australia in 2016 where they won three, they went 3-0. How many new caps were in that squad?
Not so many, I'd guess.
Yeah.
Tamana Harrison?
He had a cap, so he was not a new cap.
So new caps for that tour, and new caps, well...
They were, I'll tell you, of the 35-man, maybe, squad, there was only two new caps that Eddie Jones brought in for that tour. Do you know who they were?
Hang on. Is it going to be like...
Oh, how many years back are we going? This is
2016.
So it's seven years back. Seven, 8 years
One
ago.
Is still playing for England.
Elliot Daly?
Oh, no, he must have had caps.
No, he must have had caps by then.
He had three caps, so not many.
Not many.
Yeah, he was only 23 at the time.
What about... Jamie George has already been involved, hadn't he?
Jamie George, good shout.
Jamie George, yeah. he had six caps at that point.
Okay. It is going to be an unheralded fly half, I think. I can't think of exactly who.
There were only two fly halves that toured. So.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's not the fly halves.
Fazenford. It was a prop and a centre.
Was it someone like the guy who's gone from Harlequins to Bath, Boyce or something like that?
No, the prop is still playing now.
Not Joe Marler. No, he can't have been. No, because he was there with Lancaster.
Yeah.
Not Will Stewart. He wasn't about then.
Not Will Stewart. No. He was 23 at the time.
Dan
still
Cole's
playing now.
Involved.
Henry Thomas.
No, in the World Cup, the England
hold
World
on, I'm just
squad now.
Carl Sinclair.
Yes. And a centre who was uncapped at 29 and is no longer playing because he's now 37.
Yeah. Is it Jordan Turner Hall or something?
No.
Big Leaf? No.
And he was only just eligible to play because he had just signed for an English team.
How annoying. It's going to be something for Wasps, right?
Not Wasps.
It's just signed for an English team. Sam Burgess.
No, this is 2016, not 2015.
You said a centre. I'm thinking, because I was about to say Brad Shields, but he came in the South Africa game the next year.
Yeah, not Brad Shields.
Oh, he's going to kill me now.
You know this boy well. This boy has had a lot of airtime on this podcast.
Brad Barrett?
Not Brad Barrett.
No, of course it's not Brad Barrett. Who?
Sam Burgess. No.
No, no.
No, because he was 23.
The year after Sam Burgess. He's like Sam Burgess Mark II.
Ben Tail.
Ben Tail.
Yes.
The only two uncapped players.
It's the peak Tio horn.
Wow.
That's it. If you're relatively new to the podcast, you'll have no idea what we're talking about, but go back and listen. It was a lot of fun.
Yes.
Ben Tail was.
I remember how annoyed JB was when Ben Tail got into the Lions after I predicted it. He was fuming.
You even went to the
because I predicted Ben Tail were getting the Lions and he did. You accused
me
of having inside information. You
predicted England. No one predicted the Lions.
You must have flexed. I predicted England World Cup squad. That's right. You were like, someone must have told you that. You must have got some inside information.
You must have had. There's no way you looked at Ben Tail. He's going to go to Worcester. That's what's going to happen to him. Worcester and then England. No way.
Ben Tail.
So,
anyway,
from all of that then...
Yeah, yeah. Which nothing to do with this World Cup now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think the semi-finals that we've got, although there is some disagreement... the quarter-finals that we've got. I think we've got Australia facing England. I think we've got Argentina facing Fiji. I think we've got... I think we both picked it the other way around. Ireland facing France and New Zealand facing South Africa.
Those are tasty.
Now, I know you said you had some differences there, JB. You'd have France facing Scotland.
Yep.
And you would have... Australia.
Scotland is dangerous for France.
You'd have... It is. You'd also have Australia facing Samoa.
If you were Andy Farrell, and you could... Well, you wouldn't want to do a club call like they did in rugby league and pick your opponent, but if you could and keep it secret who you picked, so no one knew that you'd picked it, who would you pick? For the quarterfinals, like France or New Zealand? Because
probably New Zealand.
I think both teams, South Africa. I think they both pick New Zealand as a matchup.
Yeah,
South Africa France as a quarterfinal. I want to see South Africa play France after that game last autumn. One of the most brutal and brilliant rugby matches I've ever seen.
Yeah. We're all fixated on the big teams, rightly so, because they're great. I mean, they are great. It's so weird, this World Cup, because there are going to be two teams which, by some metrics, will be some of the greatest ever teams.
All right, yeah, two teams.
Yeah, so...
Definitely two. Three,
South Africa, France. You might argue Ireland, okay? You might argue Ireland. I mean, there's certainly some of the best their nations have ever produced. But if you play them against the best All Blacks team, just their sheer power and size would probably be too much for them, right?
I don't know.
Maybe.
When I look at Ireland, so just go through the Ireland team. Porter, Sheehan, Furlong, Tyburn, James Ryan, Doris, Omani, Van der Fleer. It's like
or Conan in there.
Sorry,
Conan.
I think
it's like it's an immense team.
So I think we're talking about different.
You were saying if you take this island,
if
team
you take
up
this
against,
island team and put them against like the World Cup winning All Blacks, I think Ireland would probably have a bit too much for them. Same with what I'm saying is you've got three teams.
Oh right, I see. So I thought you were saying the other.
No. So we've got three teams here. Which could legitimately be the three. Well, I mean, three
is
the best teams.
Is that because we're
that
comparing across eras? And
yes,
we're talking about. Yeah, of course. So, yeah. So the 2023.
Like the All Blacks of their time were the most dominant.
Yeah,
team.
It's hard to compare 8 years apart.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So, but you should remember, like these three teams are. I mean, they are legitimately special.
Yeah, but those players, if they were 8 years younger in that New Zealand team that won in 2015, would be.
12.
if they were 8 years younger, so they were all at the same age they won in 2015. But now Richie McCaw would be better.
Yeah, I mean,
by
look,
the same
if you get those players today at that age today. I don't know, with strength and conditioning and modern tactics, and modern coaching.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't know. Yeah. But I just think that these three teams are legitimately special, even though one of them's going out. So that's like one side of the World Cup, and that's great. The other side of the World Cup. Is like the amount of teams that are going to get really close scares with all their frayed nerves, and there's going to be a few of them.
Yeah,
reaching the quarterfinals, thinking, "Jesus Christ, we were lucky to get out."
Yeah,
there will be four games.
There will be four. Whoever makes it out will be like count themselves lucky.
They're going to be shell shocked. You're going to just get like two punch drunk fighters in the quarters,
and then they play each other.
Yeah, and then they've got to go to the semis and get their ass kicked by.
Well, that is the one downside of the lopsided draw. The quarterfinals are going to be amazing and really well matched. The semifinals could be. Like the momentum could just blow straight out of this World Cup at the semi-final stage.
And
you could, but then it picks up again in the finals.
But I think there's a risk of that. But like, look back to the... I was just trying to get the scores up. Look back to the 2019 Rugby World Cup
South Africa-Wales.
Semi-finals. The two semi-finals were really low-scoring. Like, because they are nervy positions. So there was... It was 19-20. Oh, no, sorry. That's the wrong one. So 19-7.
Yeah.
And 16-19. So no team scored more than 20 points. No team scored more than 19 points.
And if you think about those semi-finals,
they're low-scoring games.
Those were... That wasn't a good France team. And it's France-Wales in the semi.
No. It was South Africa-Wales in the semi.
Oh, sorry.
2019.
Sorry, the year before last. Sorry, the World Cup before last, right? So it was like 9-6 or something. Halfpenny misses a kick. Sam Orbison gets the red.
That was 2011. That's four years before that.
Oh, right, okay. So that's an example of two not very good teams, in my opinion.
Yes.
Two very nervy teams.
But even in that, that's a good example of the pressure of knockout rugby, because in 2011, New Zealand were way better than that French team.
Yeah.
Dussertoir was a magician. He was best player on the planet, probably, in that tournament. And he nearly won the final on his own for France. But parking Dussertoir, that France were in disarray, Livremont, the players revolted, Livremont couldn't coach anything, and they still nearly beat the All Blacks, who were head and shoulders above everyone else in the world at that time, because that's the pressure of World Cup semi-finals and finals. Yeah. So whoever makes it through, and it may well be Argentina and Australia, it could be Fiji and Wales, it could be England and Georgia, for all we know, like, whoever makes it through will have a shot. Not a great shot, but they will have a shot just because of the pressure of the occasion.
I read this differently. I think all the semis, quarters go down in exactly that way, because the good teams face the good teams, the bad teams face the bad teams.
Yeah.
And there's different types of pressure. There's like the high performance pressure of two amazing teams, and you know what I'm trying to say. The semis, though, I think are blowouts. I think Tim's right on that one. So I just think if Ireland get to semis, they're not getting out of the group.
I'd love to see France Fiji in a semi. That'd be fun.
That would be cool.
Yeah,
France Argentina.
Fiji would be cool. The ones, right, who I think would put up the best fight of these of the worst nations, because they just rolled the dice.
Who, sorry?
Fiji.
Argentina.
Oh, Argentina's got a good shot, yeah. Actually.
They've beaten all of... Yeah, other team in the world.
Argentina and
Fiji. So let's run through, because I've got on our predictor. So we've got the four matches. So Australia versus England. JB, who's going through?
Australia.
England.
I think England win that because of the... Because Australia's so inexperienced.
Oh, that the are both but, wicked. Like
that would be some great storylines.
So for that quarterfinal, I will be in and around Marseille, and I will have the option to go to the team hotel where they have to put up a coach and a couple of players for interviews and stuff. And
awesome.
I would be going. Do you know what? If I had to pick, I'm going to go and chat to Eddie. I'm 100%. I'm going to go see what Eddie's got to say.
I love Eddie.
Dynamite. I love him. He's great. I miss him.
So, okay, I'm going to put Australia through, JB. I'm going to side with you, actually. Okay. So Australia go through to one semi. Then
Argentina-Fiji.
I think it'll be Argentina. I think they'll have too much.
Yep.
Then we've got Ireland versus France.
France.
I think France. And it does depend who they've got available, but France in France.
Yeah.
And then close, New Zealand v South Africa.
Knife edge.
New Zealand, South Africa.
It's like rugby championship matchup or Twickenham matchup. It could go either way. That one.
I think they hate
each other. Those two teams, the two winningest teams in the World Cup.
Three wins each in the big tournament. Give me South Africa then. I know I said France, New Zealand, but. South Africa are going through that.
I mean, this is all hypothetical because this is just playing out.
And then in this, then we have Australia France repeat of the game we had a few weeks ago,
very first ever World Cup semi final.
France, and then Argentina,
South Africa,
France, and France, South Africa final.
That would be great.
Oh,
would be amazing.
And, like, it would just be
any. I don't care what the final. Sorry, I'm talking over. I'm just getting excited. Any final would be amazing. But that would be really.
Well, no,
really
England
fun.
Would be bad, wouldn't it? England Wales would be bad.
England Wales would be bad. I'd take it as an Englishman. I'd hate Wales to win, though.
I hope.
Can they both lose?
Now we've gone through that. Now I'm kind of oddly hoping that France don't play Ireland in the quarterfinal.
Do you know what?
I would like to see that being a final. I would like. There's definitely a new name on the trophy.
France versus France versus South Africa would be great, because we can finally rip up the notion that it's a skills game with collisions occasionally, or whatever the RFU you like to say. You can just look at these two teams and go, no, it's about big men fighting big men and smashing into contact over and over and over again.
I think what
repeatedly.
I think they are both examples of doing all of it.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a mixture, right? But when you've got Andre Esterhazy facing off against Jonathan Dante, you're going to have to really sell me on the priority here is skills.
Matchups everywhere in that. Olivon and Khaleesi, two of like the most amazing men
and leaders
in rugby, and leaders,
and also absolute savages that want to rip off your face.
Yeah,
which, you know, don't forget that, because that's how they got there. Like, you know, everyone treats them like they're kittens or puppies. They're not. They're absolute murderers.
Marchand against Marks, Antonio against Kitsoff, Malherbe against Bai.
All lovely men.
Oh, it's just amazing, that matchup.
Yeah, just that's what it's about. That is what it's about. You know, Etzebeth, his eyes bulging through his head against whoever it is.
Villiers versus Colby.
De Pont
Faf. The Toulon boy. I know Colby's not at Toulon anymore, but the Toulon boys on the wings opposite each other.
But, you know, they only get to operate if their big boys do the job first. That's that's the law of the jungle.
What are your general... if that was the final, I say France are a new name on the Webb Ellis Trophy. And that leads me to a question I was going to ask you. What are your kind of hopes or fears for the tournament? And I'll just lead off with that one. A hope of mine is that we emerge from the Rugby World Cup with way more people globally interested and engaged with the sport. And I think a France win would do that, because in Antoine Dupont, you've got a guy that can carry the sport on his shoulders.
I'm really down on this, I'm afraid. And I just don't think the World Cup is the vehicle to grow the game. It's not the vehicle to get engagement. It's none of these things. It's a one-off. And the example I'd give is the Olympics. Everybody loves 100 metres, but does anyone watch a Diamond League after the 100 metres is over? Sadly not. The answer to your question, Tim...
People do. Like, it's not no one. It's not 100%. Yeah, okay. It's not 100% conversion rate.
It's not 100%, that's and it. That is true.
But it's not 0% conversion rate either.
Yeah, I just don't think it moves the needle. That's what I would say, because the backup product isn't there. So, like, the next offering isn't there for people. Whereas if you find yourself stumbling into, for instance, top 14, I've stumbled into Super Rugby once when I was a young man, when Super Rugby was really good, and I watched every single week. And that's what you need. You need a proposition that is open to people every single week.
Well, okay, well, these things can bubble outwards. If France were to win the World Cup and Antoine Dupont was to be the face of rugby, then the influence of the top 14 and its many professional leagues below would be magnified even more, and other countries would look to that and take a lead from it.
Yeah,
and
I just don't think that's how it works, unfortunately. I think the better bet for engagement... Oh, God, I feel like I'm just ruining your whole point here. But the better one for engagement would have been like the Heineken Cup 20 years ago, when it was on terrestrial TV and, you know, people could watch this stuff. But, yeah, I don't think the World Cup's going to move the needle. I think it's going to be great for a few weeks. It'll cover up some deficiencies in the game, which will continue to fester and rot, and we're still on the same road to oblivion regardless.
That's a lovely, happy thought. But you kind of want that to happen, though. So I think...
No, I do. Well, look, it's a risky strategy, right? It's like, I hope my house burns down so I can build a better one, right? So it's very, very risky, because there's no guarantee I could build a better one. Mm. I'd like it just to get better. But the fact of the matter is, it won't under this leadership and it won't under this culture, frankly. So it needs to have something absolutely radical happen to it. If we want to save the game?
Save the game you love. Yeah, because the game's going to exist. Rugby's going to be here.
It will not.
It will.
It will not, Tim.
Rugby will be here.
Agree to disagree on that. Okay. Professional rugby will not be...
I didn't say... All I said was rugby's going to be here. It's like Wasps. Wasps are still going to be at a club. London Irish is going to be a club.
Okay.
And actually... And
Joe, I'm 100%...
One of our listeners, I'm just getting the name. Sorry, Joe. I've just forgotten your surname and I wanted to get it right. Friend of the pod. London Irish fan. Sorry, Joe.
Excellent Irish fan.
Oh, man. I can't find. Anyway, Joe got in touch to say that London Irish Amateurs got a massive crowd against Farnham this weekend.
Oh, wonderful. That's
Look,
good.
If you think rugby's going to exist...
Joe.
In the same way that Wasps will exist, I back you 100% there. You know, we are agreeing. Because that's what I think it will come to. You know, Wasps Amateurs, London Irish Amateurs, that's where it will be. There'll be a hardcore of people that want the game to succeed. But, you know, we're not seeing...
Joe Riley. Okay. Came to me. Sorry.
Joe Riley. Friend of the pod.
No.
You just said Joe Riley.
Yeah.
I should have just said Joe Riley.
By the way, have you seen some of our other emails from this week? There have been some belting emails.
Well, let's conclude this, though. Hopes and fears. So I've put one hope forward that we have maybe a new name on the trophy or at least a person who can... inspire, can carry rugby on their shoulders for the foreseeable. I think in Antoine Dupont, we have got quite possibly the greatest player ever to play rugby playing rugby right now.
Yeah, I think that's not just hyperbole.
We should all want France to win because someone needs to carry this game forward. And I think the only people that can really logically do it would be the French. I think South Africa winning is great for that team. It's a great rugby nation. But as an actual sovereign state, it's an absolute disaster. Like, pinning your hopes on anything South African is not a good
idea. Ireland winning would be a good message for long-term, thoughtful planning and execution.
I totally agree with that as well, actually. So Ireland and France. If you're just thinking about rugby, you want Ireland and France to win this.
Yeah. Or Fiji.
Or Fiji.
What a story. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Or Fiji. Do you know, weirdly, Fiji might be the team that actually grew the sport the most in our markets.
Yeah.
That might be.
Yeah. And other markets as well.
Yeah, that really captures the imagination. Like, you can imagine that being covered
That's
in
a
America.
Movie. That's a film.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it really would be.
Yeah, exactly. So, but sadly, I don't think that's something. It could do.
It's not impossible, but it's unlikely.
It's unlikely. A fear I have is that
England winning World Cup.
We'll get onto that. Well, yeah. So one point on that quickly is there a danger because of the lopsided draw that England managed to get themselves to a semi-final and then the changes that are necessary and the lessons that need to be learned don't get learned. Don't
100%.
Happen.
That is exactly the danger.
There is, but. As a RFU point, rather than specifically a Borthwick point, just because I have faith in Borthwick, although I obviously expressed my concern with the wider coaching setup previously.
I would genuinely love Borthwick to win a World Cup. He's a great guy. I just think maybe not this World Cup, but a World Cup. I think he's the kind of guy who I'd just really like to see win it. And I'd say the same, a lot of this England team I'd like to see be successful. But it's that wider thing, isn't it?
And on the Borthwick point, because he's copping a lot of heat at the minute. And I think maybe deservedly so, for the reasons Phil pointed out last week, that he has hired a very inexperienced team of coaches, which may be a bit green behind the ears. However, I would also point out Clive Woodward didn't do very well in his first World Cup. Not steamrolled by Joan Lomu in a quarter final.
Yeah, he's got to tread quite a fine line, because if he does too badly, he... might not live to see another World Cup, might not live to see another Six Nations. But, well, who knows what they'd do, whether they can afford it or not.
If enough people and pundits and ex-pros tweet and talk enough, it'll happen.
I just don't know. I kind of disagree, because the Borthwicks go so early, Sweeney has to go early. Hang on. Yeah, okay.
Is it worth it?
I'd sacrifice Borthwick for Sweeney.
Anyway,
so I would tell you who would sacrifice Borthwick for Sweeney. Bill Sweeney,
definitely.
So, but one of my fears is that cards and a marginal high tackle is going to have a disproportionately massive impact on this World Cup.
Yeah, and I've made the point previously that I don't think a single card is as big as people think. I don't think a single card ruins a game unless you've got a mismatch of teams anyway, and it just exacerbates a mismatch. I think there are two problems. One, you will have there's risk of multiple cards. Cards totally changes the game. Like, teams do train for 14 men. They do not train for 13 men. And even if you do, there's just too much space. And the other thing is the inconsistency of the decision making and the complexity of the decision making process. Look at the Owen Farrell decision. Yellow, upgraded to red, downgraded back to yellow, and then upgraded back to red again for a single tackle.
I'll chuck in a third element, Phil, is that the suspensions. Now, World Rugby do not make any differentiation between a World Cup quarterfinal and a Premiership Cup game against Ealing Trailblazers. Officially, they don't. But that. Imagine that. Imagine a marginal high tackle Antoine Dupont makes in a World Cup semi-final, and he gets a red card, but France managed to get through, and he doesn't play in the final.
Yeah,
yeah.
This sort of stuff. Rugby doesn't help itself with this sort of thing.
Well, it's nonsense, isn't it? The whole high tackle debate is nonsense. Michael Owen perfectly summarised it. Interestingly, someone brought up subconcussive hits today on some form. Maybe it might have even been Progressive Rugby. They mentioned. Do you hear the story today? Like, we've got to this. Alex Popham.
But let's just conclude the World Cup thing, firstly. So, any more hopes and fears for the World Cup?
No.
That is a big fear. The cards.
Cards could.
But no, yeah. Hopes. The hopes we've covered. Just a good tournament. Close games. Not too many. We will get some. When New Zealand play Namibia, you're going to get a 90-point win.
I do hope that people follow the storylines. Yeah. I hope that the storylines are communicated by the press well. I hope by the commentary teams well. I hope that they don't employ idiots like Brian Moore to say, well, the right France team showed up today. Or, you know, pundits to say things like, oh, well, that fearsome England pack, when they're not. You know, I want them to tell the actual story of the teams and who,
well,
and
I mean, who they are. New media is where it's at for that. Podcasts and YouTube and stuff.
Hey, if you want to find out where the narratives are at, YouTube.
So on that, I was picking some of the games I was going to, and on that game where England are playing Chile, I went, well, I'm not interested in that, whereas Argentina Samoa in St Etienne, that's where there could be a story.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of stuff I'm hunting down.
So you just made me think, I've been listening to the Nike episode of Acquired today.
Worth listening to?
Very much so. If you read Shoe Dog.
No, I haven't.
So Chew Dog, I think I've recommended before. Chew Dog's brilliant, which is the book, the memoirs of Phil Knight, one of the founders of Nike. Probably not officially the founder, because there was Bill Bowerman as well, but one of the two main guys, and he was the main guy. Anyway, that stops pre-Jordan. So that stops in like the late 70s, early 80s, whereas Acquired, so Shoe Dog doesn't go on to doesn't go on to Jordan, doesn't go on to the 90s, doesn't go on to the scandal with the sweatshops in East Asia and any of that stuff, but it doesn't go on to good and bad. And they're talking about Nike's strategy with basketball, particularly from a business strategy perspective. And it's to back the players, not the teams.
Yes.
Because the players are bigger. Each player, they are like, they describe them as being like Netflix shows. Because each player has their story, and these players are bigger than the leagues. And in some instances, this is bigger than the sports. Like, Michael Jordan's earnings through the Nike deal, the Jordan brand, it's 20, 30, 40x his playing earnings.
Incredible, isn't it?
It's, they were saying that Jordan brand is growing at 35% per year revenue growth for Nike 20 years after he finished playing.
That's incredible.
It's unbelievable. Well, he's picking up 5%
when
of that.
When I first heard or was aware of the name Jordan, right, he was still playing, but it was more synonymous with the actual... it was unclear to me what the link was to the basketball player. It's just the Jordans.
Jordan, yeah. So anyway, my point is that the story, there will be amazing storylines in the games, in the teams. But actually, Tim, to your point about Antoine Dupont, who is this this amazing player, and also has a little bit of fun and has some charisma. And he's captain in France in a home World Cup. The individual storylines I want to see a little bit more of. So I'm hoping that is covered. We will do our best to cover it, but I'm hoping it's covered elsewhere as well.
Weenie Antonio's story is incredible. Yeah. Picked up like playing like third division rugby when he was just travelling around France, and he was part of
an acting troupe.
A Shakespeare acting troupe with his brothers.
Thing is with Weenie Antonio is, I guess the amazing part of the story is that guy wasn't picked up sooner. Yeah. Like, it's not like he was a talented scrum half and made it the hot. I mean, he's a big piece of furniture.
6'5", 150 kg.
Yeah, how did you know he was going to be good? So, yeah, that's the story. Why was he not picked up?
Yeah.
There we go. That's your Rugby World Cup, which, of course, I can't wait. I cannot wait.
So when do you fly?
Tuesday.
Tuesday
to Paris.
Yeah.
And then pick up the camper van from the Ford headquarters there.
Very nice.
And then I've got to get my way to Marseille over the next couple of days. Basically,
oh, my word.
England.
Which is a long old drive.
It's a big country, yeah.
It's about 8 hours driving.
It's more than that.
I would have thought it's more than that. I don't actually know.
I think it's about 8 hours driving.
Yeah. I think you're on 12, 13, surely.
So I've driven from the Dordogne down to Toulouse, and that was about 6 hours.
Do not get caught speeding.
No, I don't intend to.
Do not even consider.
You're in a camper van. You'll be fine.
Yeah. One thing I've been told, I think I might mention this before. I've been warned by the people from Ford, so they're lending me this transit nugget thing, which is like their version of the
California thing.
The California, yeah, kind of thing. Yeah. Anyway, they've said, "Oh, sorry, it's coming from Germany, so just sorry about that." I was like, "What do you mean?" They said, "Oh, we'll have German stickers on it, so you'll get loads of shit from people on
what?"
Yeah.
They've
said apparently if you're German with German plates on, you get loads of people just like sticking the finger up.
Oh,
at
really?
You.
Like kind still, of like if you got English plates driving through parts of Wales, like Carnarvon or something.
Yeah, maybe. So there's obviously like still some deep rooted stuff. I mean, I can imagine if you were going through. That said, every single village or town I've been to in France has little monuments. So like they were properly occupied.
So I was driving around Salford the other day, as one does. And I passed a road called Verdun Street. Now, you know what Verdun is. I mean, you must know what Verdun is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, but a lot of people don't know what Verdun is.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just took me down the rabbit hole of reading about the Battle of Verdun again. And if you haven't read about it, just bring it up and read it. And it blows your mind.
Yeah.
It's amazing those two countries can actually coexist, hundreds of years, 100 plus years on. I mean, it's just incredible.
So it's 800 kilometres, although That is about 8 hours if you're doing
80 kilometres.
No, it'd be 10 hours if you're doing 80 kilometres an hour. It'd be 8 hours if you're doing 100 kilometres per hour. So if you're doing 100 kilometres per hour, which is about 60
miles an hour,
62-ish miles an hour.
No brakes.
You'll be fine.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to stop on the Tuesday night somewhere.
Your route takes you directly through Lyon as well.
Yeah. I want to arrive in Marseille Wednesday night, and then on the Thursday I'll be going to the Marseille Airport Hilton Hotel where the England team will be arriving.
Nice. The thing about you, Tim, which people don't know, but I do, you're a very good driver when hungover. so you'll be fine to get up early and just get moving.
the other World War One battle, my favourite World War One battle to read about. Just because it's like the stories are mind blowing. Passchendaele.
I've not actually read that.
It was like the weather was horrific. So, and where there'd been so many shells dropped, there were huge craters, and there was so much rain that the craters filled up with water to the point that the Allied forces used duck boards to get across towards the German front line. So you can imagine, like, the German guns, basically, like, these Allied guys are walking on bits of wood, which means that they can't dodge. And there's this unbelievable story.
And you can't undulate, can you? You can't use the terrain features.
The New Zealand team were somewhere near some of these battlegrounds, so they went and visited some of this. And that's one of the things I'd like to do while I'm in France, is go and visit some of this
stuff.
Yeah,
I think.
But the Passchendaele one just haunts me. There's this account from a soldier. Basically, one guy sort of slipped into one of these holes, crater, and he got stuck in them. He got stuck in the mud. Couldn't get out of this crater, which had water in it
as it fills up.
And basically, he was he wasn't in a position where anyone could help him because they were on these duck boards. And basically, the soldier gave an account of over several days walking back and forward past this guy as he just got slightly higher. The water was slightly higher.
Oh, my God.
My word.
I know. It's just, like, some of the shit we complain about and just read some World War One accounts.
Yeah,
and
that's yeah,
just
like, yeah, well, passionate, because the battle that I would always go to would be Ypres.
Yeah.
And Passchendaele is like adjacent to or part of the Ypres region. And it's, you just look at the numbers of casualties, that it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's just mind-blowing, yeah.
Linking to military stuff, we got one of the best emails I think I've ever, ever read.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mentioned the other day about, you know, generals getting fired. Now, I'm not going to read the whole email because it is a long old email and I don't like reading emails in its entirety because I'm just not very good at picking out the best parts. But I'm just trying to find who sent it. He just deserves a shout out. Ex-army captain. It's just, it was genuinely one of the most enjoyable emails that I have ever, ever had.
It was, and have you got the name?
David F. Heathcote, is it?
I don't know.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. David F. Heathcote, thank you very much. I absolutely love that email.
Captain.
Now retired.
Captain David retired. Heathcote.
Well, I love the point, because he puts so much flesh on the bones of a point that we often make without having the detailed knowledge behind it around a peacetime number 8 and a wartime number 8, like, which we kind of flippantly joke about, but knowing that there is something behind there. But the phrase he used was the regulators and disruptors.
That's it, yes.
So he says, and this has great analogies for business as well, like the regulators in peacetime, and I'm probably butchering it, so apologies, David, but in peacetime, basically, you want men who will follow the process.
Yeah.
Who will follow the company line.
Who will maintain the infrastructure and the institutions.
Yes. And they're all well and good in a peacetime operation, but as soon as you're in wartime, that is no good, because sometimes some of those institutions and functions and processes are not fit for purpose.
Yep.
Some of them need to be ripped up and started again. Mm. And sometimes you just don't have the time or the facilities. Yeah, they're fit for a different purpose. And you have to bring in the disruptors. And it's a great lens, that regulators and disruptors lens, to look at things through.
Yeah, yeah, Captain, now retired, Captain David F. Heathcote, uses the example of the England players and says, because the England squad is full of...
Regulators,
there will be none of this so-called revolt, as there was in 2007.
Yes.
Because none of the guys none of the disruptors are in there. It's all company men that are there. So he doesn't expect it to happen. And there's a lot of people been talking about this. And Owen Slott did a really interesting article basically saying, come on, the Owen Farrell, this is your time to lead.
Yes, I saw that.
But it was quite a good article, actually. But also in the same article saying, basically making the same point. He's a good company man. It's not going to happen.
And he's got history with Borthwick as well.
In Russell, right? So this might...
Oh, and everyone's defending their own position because it's worth quite a lot of cash.
And we also look at like the smaller nations. So I have been on record of criticising England for not getting lads like Tompkins and Harris, and but also I'm full of praise for lads like Finn Russell, who would never have made England just because of his body shape. Mm. But because of you've got a narrow playing pool to pick from, maybe you inadvertently do pick these disruptor types. Well, whereas the whole point of England is you've got a huge playing pool.
It's a bit of the Moneyball argument. Like, they, once you look past the like slightly unusual aesthetics, you look at the stats and you look at their ability.
England picked Thomas Waldron.
Yes, they did.
True. Very true. Whereas with England, because if you've got two players who stats or on the face it, they might appear to be roughly as good as each other, they pick the aesthetic one rather than the one who looks like he's...
PSP's got given many more chances than he probably deserves.
Yeah, yeah. England are not the only ones to do it.
Yeah.
And for someone who is as physically capable and impressive as PSP's, you're going to give him a few chances.
Yeah, we must have had something like 30 emails this week, at least. I've read every one of them. The quality of the emails that are coming through are real. Because we might not mention them by name, but actually it gives us so much content and thoughts throughout the week to actually... structure
pass
conversations. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this is a bit everyone's been waiting for. There's some actual rugby this weekend, boys. Who's excited?
Well, the top 14's been going on for 2 weeks, JB, and you've not watched a game as far as I'm aware.
Because we all know that's not where it's at. So as hard as I tried to walk away from the game last year, I'd had a few pre-season games, wasn't feeling it. The first weekend of club rugby,
yeah.
I wasn't involved.
Oh.
And I'm looking at the scores, and I tell you what, I am itching to get back in the battle.
What I want to know with that context is, do you think you will use that experience of having gone so hard for weeks and weeks, months and months, I'm giving up, that's it, I'm done, it's over, and now you're not. Do you think you will take that forward and maybe temper some of those strong reactions?
No, I think that's a nonsense idea.
Yeah, JV tempering those reactions.
Not only that. So the way I look at my rugby now, like, I wanted to quit this podcast. I'm not really that interested in rugby. But on the other hand, I have done it for 10 years. And I think what my duty is now is to document the demise of the game. Because if I disappear tomorrow, right, the podcasts are out there at the moment with a similar size listenership to us. I mean, there are some niche ones that talk nonsense, but like a similar size, you know, podcast which is actually taken seriously, I don't think they do cover the demise of the game in the same way that we do. I don't think they cover the club game or the grassroots game nearly as good as us. Mm. So I do have that sort of duty to do something.
I agree with
this. I don't want to let down. Yeah. I'm not... If it wasn't my mates, if I'd moved to, say, Coventry or somewhere, I would not be seeking a new club. I would not be playing. But the fact is, you do miss the clubhouse. And that's kind of the most cynical, sinister part of England, is they know that you're hooked on going down to see your mates, and they're just relying on that you'll carry on going. And sadly, that's probably exactly what I'm going to do.
I do... I think... I love your passion. I guess one of the... Okay, we're just having like a discussion live on the podcast. I suppose this is what we're like with our audience. We're involved them in it. I guess the only issue may be documenting the demise of rugby. It means you may well end up fishing in a smaller and smaller pool of listeners, because that's not the sort of thing people want to hear about.
Well, we're going to have a smaller and smaller pool anyway, I think. Mm. Yeah, I just don't think so.
Our numbers have been stable.
Yeah, because we're good at what we do. But you know, I was talking to a guy in a barbecue yesterday who is your classic casual rugby fan. Played at Bourneville Threes for a bit. Really, really enjoyed his experience. Loved going to watch Six Nations. He says he's on the verge of a World Cup, and just no one's really talking about it. Like, he used to go with all of his mates to watch big internationals. No one's doing that. Used to take the girls. Used to take a few mates who were just football fans, and everyone would love it. And they've just slowly stopped. And we had a good half an hour about Owen Farrell, of all people. He's like, well, if that's what the game is, I don't want to watch it. And I think a lot of people feel like that.
What, Owen Farrell?
No. His treatment for the red card.
Oh, I see.
So if that's a red card, this isn't a game
That's the point Phil made the other week, like when he chatted to casual rugby fans who aren't up to speed with the nuances of every intricate
part of the
tackle protocol framework flowchart. They're like, what's going on?
Mm. Yeah. The authorities are completely neglecting the needs of the game. Yeah, so I think there probably will be a smaller pond. I'm quite comfortable with that. But we're going to have to document the demise of the whole thing.
There was some rugby this weekend.
Yes.
And
so,
Sedgley Park.
I didn't see Sedgley score.
Got back in National League One.
A famous win.
Back in League One against Richmond.
They got promoted. Richmond got relegated. It was at Park. And Richmond were down by 9 points with...
Sedgley were
down by 9 points with about 4 minutes to go.
Yeah.
Wow.
And scored a try in the 77th minute and then an 80th plus minute penalty to win 32-31.
Crikey, that is a big win.
Yeah.
Did a friend of the pod, Ben Black, play?
I'd not checked the team, but last time I spoke to him, I think he was going to retire.
Oh, no.
He's not going to play on this season, but I don't actually know.
Play for? So I spent... the best part of half an hour today trying to persuade Jake Cooper Woolley to come down to Talk H to take my position. You know, greatness deserves to be replaced by greatness. And he's thinking of going, do you know, to which club?
Which club?
Well, we do know.
Would pay massively over the odds for players. Although, perhaps not massively over the odds for Jake Cooper Woolley.
I wouldn't say he's over the odds.
Our friends at Rosendale.
Rosendale, allegedly. So Rosendale could be going to war with Jake Cooper Woolley. Barry McGuigan played this week, and Denny Solomona at 13. That's a fearsome proposition for level 5. So yeah, they're still on the hunt. If you want cash and you want it now, I'd go to Rosendale. But no, on a serious note, we played Rosendale last year in the Cup, and it's a really nice club. I did enjoy it there, and good on them for wanting a bit of ambition.
Mm.
You know, you need people. So as talking to
I'm not sure I agree that splashing out loads of cash at level 5 is a good thing for the sport.
Ultimately, it is their money.
Invest in the infrastructure.
Well, I do make this joke about Rosendale. Yeah. Like, why are you paying £400 for a back row?
Get some floodlights.
When you don't have the floodlights.
Get
some fucking floodlights. But, you know, if you want to spend your money that way, you spend your money that way. Maybe you'll get floodlights at level 4. You know, I don't know how that works.
Well, Byron McGuigan got 4 tries.
Did he? Go on, Byron.
Against Wirral, 61-33 win.
Good lad.
61-33, big high scoring game.
Yeah.
Defence optional.
94. But the question, JB, like more importantly about any result, is how is the tackle law thing bedding in from what you've seen or heard?
I have not spoke to many lads at Talk H this week about their game. Judging by our score, it didn't bother them one bit. One of our friends in North Wales had a yellow card for it. It seems to be... Well, actually, I did hear from the Aspall game. So Aspall this year are going to be very, very good at level 7 in the Northwest. And their conclusion was the refs are going to use it to level up the game. So they were 20 points up in like 10 minutes in. And then all of a sudden, high shots started raining in. And the other one I heard was...
Now, Aspall is rugby league territory, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's Wigan.
They like to hit high?
They do like... They've been taught...
They've been taught the proper way from an
early traditional
age.
Way.
Yeah, the traditional
high.
Northern way.
Hitting stick.
And someone else told me as well that, as talking to some boys in Aylesbury, because Aylesbury won. Great win for Aylesbury. Marlow lost, I'm afraid to say, Tim.
Yeah, I know my boys lost.
But tell you what is happening, 11th of November, there's no other rugby going on 11th of November. Marlow Aylesbury at Aylesbury.
Oh, now, big game.
You know, if you think that the World Cup's exciting, that's because you've not been to Marlow Aylesbury. So we'll have a full rundown of that game as and when it happens.
Rafi Quirk's Broughton Park with a win.
Finish off on that. Aylesbury were very much of the opinion that first half didn't exist. Second half, it massively existed. So refs are just... They're struggling with it as much as anyone else. It just comes down to the point, like, why do it? Why do it if it's going to make no difference whatsoever?
Yeah.
You know, both with enforcement, both with injury. Like, the whole thing is an absolute farce. So, sorry, Rafi Quirk's Broughton Park did what?
Got a win against Wilmslow, first game of the season.
Right, so people need to pay attention to this. Level 7 this year, Talk H's League. We have 2 teams in there. Now, just to give you an idea of the scale... I mean, actually, I'm not the guy to give you an idea of the scale. How good were Wilmslow back in the day, Tim?
How good were... that was... Wilmslow had international players. My old man was a policeman in Manchester, and Wilmslow was his club, and he regularly tells stories about going on the piss with Steve Smith, who was the England hooker, and what was the name of the scrum half?
No, Steve Smith is a scrum half.
Steve Smith was a scrum half.
Yeah.
No, Steve Smith was a...
No, definitely scrum half.
Scrum half. There was an England hooker as well. I can't remember the name. There was an England hooker who played for Wilmslow as well. They were one of the top teams.
Do you know why I know Steve Smith was a scrum half?
Yeah.
Steve Smith is directly responsible for the success of Sale Sharks. Because he introduced Simon Orange to rugby. That's how I know.
Yeah, so and Wilmslow versus Broughton Park was historically
a massive game
because you had Tony Neary, the England open side, Steve Smith, the England scrum half, and it was a big grudge match.
So Tony Neary, can I say what happened to Tony Neary?
Well, his name isn't up in the Broughton Park club anymore.
It's not. Maybe look it up. But yeah, Tony Neary, huge name around here. Broughton Park was a massive club. These were the two biggest amateur clubs. There's a story going around, that went around at Wilmslow, that one Will Carlin showed up to play, introduced himself, expected to get in the first team, said, no, you may not play. So like, that's how good they were back in the day. Both of those clubs have found themselves at level 7 with Talk H. Talk H tell a story back in the day of Broughton Park. This is when you had no substitutes, right? Broughton Park didn't have a fullback. So the regular thing was just to phone around the local clubs and get the best player that you could. So they just phone up Talk H, say, we need your fullback today. No matter what you were doing, you had to send your fullback to Broughton Park. And now I'm looking forward to smashing them everywhere.
Yeah.
When is Broughton Park Talk H? I'm genuinely interested in that fixture.
About five or six weeks' time, I think. It's good. I can't wait for that game. That's probably 50% of the reason I still want to play. That one game.
Peak JB.
Yeah, they're going to be good. They are. They always bounce back from level 7. But you've got some good teams there now.
Mm.
Real good teams. Yep, it's all very exciting stuff. It's the local stuff which gets me much more excited than World Cups and Premiership and whatnot. Much, much more excited.
Mm.
Alex Popham, you wanted to talk about as well.
Yeah. A very sad story in some ways, but kind of like, it just proves the point, doesn't it? So if you're not following the story of this absolute grift of an organisation, Progressive Rugby. Now, what their motives are, I mean, they'll say, I don't know what the motives are.
If you just, like, again, it's just, when you preface stuff and put names around it, like, a lot of people just turn off, whereas actually, if you just present the facts.
Well, we don't know what.
Like, this absolute grift of an organisation. Progressive Rugby.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Like, I don't know why we need the lectures about how to communicate things, because ultimately,
because I want you to
argue
your point on the merits.
No, because the merits are irrelevant largely, right? So the merits of an argument don't really matter. When there's a psychopath with high heels that manages to get extra chiefs to spend millions of pounds changing their branding because all that they did was sling insults and innuendo at them, you learn the lesson the hard way, don't you?
You don't persuade anybody. That's
except
what I'm
saying. they did, Tim, they won.
No, you don't persuade anyone. So by going for pejoratives,
so hang on, so
and,
you think
ad hominem.
So you think the tactics, right, of calling extra chiefs racist over and over and over again, they didn't work.
You're arguing a different point.
They didn't work.
I'm saying when you go ad hominem,
so when I use those tactics they won't work. But when other people do, they do work.
But they argued a lot more than just that, didn't they?
No. The whole basis of their argument was they're racist.
But it's causing offence. It was a lot more nuanced than that.
No, it was just basically racist.
Now, it wasn't much more nuanced than that.
It was. Yeah. So
what I'm saying is that the facts stack up in your favour.
All right, so if I was doing the non-nuanced one, Progressive Rugby or money-grabbing grifters. If I was to do the... If I was to do slightly more nuanced than that, sorry, the less nuanced version, the more nuanced version is they are an organisation interested in raising money for people who have suffered brain damage through rugby or something like that, which of course is nonsense. They are a pressure group. They are a pressure group interested in cash. That's it. And they use really, really dodgy tactics. And the tactics are basically this, which is we must engage in a dialogue in rugby until we get exactly our way. You must be educated until you think in exactly the right way. And should you not engage with them, or should you not do exactly what they say, they slay exactly what you said, Tim, the things that don't work. Ad hominems and insults and innuendo at everyone. And it does work.
When they go low, you go high.
Fuck that! Who do you want? Michelle Obama?
Yeah. Well.
Have you seen a single incident when this has ever worked? Right, and also, it's not as if I'm not presenting the facts. These are the facts.
Yeah,
right.
I think at the moment, Vivek Ramaswamy is a brilliant example of someone who's doing exactly this.
Well, I don't want to go into the weeds on US presidential.
If
I'm looking right at an organisation that does nothing but sling mud, ad hominems, and innuendo, and I'm to talk about that in an objective manner, you would call them grifters because that is the objective word for it. That is, you're not talking about a sincere organisation, and yet here they are, given airtime by BBC Five Live. You know, influencing the debates. They're doing all the things that people who don't engage in these things don't get to do. So if everyone gets to know them as like concussion grifters, which is exactly what they are, they are trying to utilise the misfortune of others, the medical misfortune of others, in order to push their agenda.
What I'm saying is, when they speak the way you're describing, they speak, they talk to the 20-30% of people who already agree with them. And all I'm saying to you is, when you talk the way you
but
talk,
that's all they need to do.
No. Yeah, but when you talk, all you do is confirm the opinions of the 20-30 percent of people who agree with you. And I agree largely with you. But if you just start with
if 20-30% of those people, right, were actively engaged and actually made enough noise, you might be able to save the game. As it happens, the reasonable people, the silent majority, they just sit there and take it. Mm-hmm. And the people that are making the noise, Tim, or the psychopaths in high heels calling Exeter Chiefs racist over and over again, it's nearly bankrupt them. And that's one of the best clubs in the entire country. Like, that makes no sense. So if you're willing to stand on the sidelines and let it all I think go to hell on principle. You know, you may do that.
No, I think there's somewhere between standing on the sidelines and let it go into hell, quote unquote, and calling someone a psychopath in high heels. I think there's somewhere in the middle that exists.
I don't think. Okay, I'm not sure there is. I'm not sure there is.
All right, fair enough.
So
fair enough.
Yeah, that's where I am with that. So this is actually quite a sad story. So we'll get to kind of a sad story.
Well,
this proves the point, doesn't it? Which is everything has a risk.
It is a sad story. Yeah.
So Alex Popham was doing a
Ironman or triathlon.
Yeah. Ironman or triathlon today. Now he gets kicked in the head in his swim in the swim portion. Suffers a concussion and has to withdraw. Now, we don't need to point out the irony here, because Progressive Rugby have already pointed it out. But if you can get concussed in something like swimming, what do you do? Do you ban swimming? Like, do we now say that it's unsafe? Do we then...
Just ban leg kicks in swimming.
Leg kicks, yeah. Do we need to send people on swimming courses so they don't kick people? I mean, it's completely unintentional, right? And... you might argue, well, Alex has already got a history of concussions. If he's got a history of concussions, why is he going into a body of water with a load of flailing legs? It makes me think that Progressive Rugby don't take the safety of their campaigners seriously at all, really. In fact, they're quite happy to profit off their efforts without actually thinking about any of their welfare whatsoever. Because that's exactly what they would say about rugby if this happened in our sport. So yeah, very, very sad. Alex Popham couldn't complete his triathlon, but taken to hospital. Can't remember things. I would ask, why is he doing it in the first place? And second of all, do we ban swimming now, and should we start up a group called Progressive Swimming?
Well, rather than saying why is he doing it at all, what I would say is have your own relationship with risk and everything.
Well,
including swimming carries an inherent danger.
Well, swimming's profoundly dangerous. Swimming in a large body
of water. Open water swimming, yeah, especially.
It is profoundly dangerous. So don't do it. Do it if you want to. I wouldn't do it.
A friend of mine, a guy I played rugby with at uni, did the Cork Ironman last week or 2 weeks ago, and two people died in the swim.
Did they?
In an Ironman.
I mean...
So these are obviously... fairly fit people in fairly good condition.
Yeah, very well trained. I mean, my brother's done Ironman, and the amount of training he needs to do for it is...
Unbelievable. Yeah, yeah. Because just to complete an Ironman is a...
Well, the fact that two people died in it, I mean, no one wants that, but it does show how hard, like, how hard the bloody thing is.
It's hard and risky, yeah. And there was dreadful conditions.
Do you know one of the things that I think about these concussion lawsuits and the way they're going, which is they're sort of self-fulfilling, and... one of the worst and most unsavoury aspects of them is that you find guys like Alex Popham and like Steve Thompson who were once somebody, and it's very sad to say this, but their identity was professional sportsmen. And when you leave professional sports, I think some people really, really struggle with it. I think that's a very serious point which is never really dealt with. You know, people talk about mental health and whatnot, a subject I'm very sceptical of, but I think a real thing is when you're removed from a group of players and from the limelight, you struggle to deal with that. I think what Progressive Rugby does and what the campaigning does is it makes them someone again, and I think it's a very, very awkward incentive to deal with, because I think half of this campaigning is them desperate to be someone.
I think that
that's why it's so sad, actually.
Yeah,
they're desperate to be someone again, and the way that they gain relevance is by taking things off other people. I have nothing but sympathy for the condition that they find themselves in, but if they're going to fight this fight against the sport which I play and which has given me so much, they've got to be, they've got to expect to be treated more harshly.
That point around the, I always think of the phrase, graveyards are full of indispensable men.
Yeah.
Like, not being indispensable anymore. Like, the realisation that you are no longer indispensable, yeah, can no longer do the thing that made you who you are, is a very, very difficult position to be in.
It's horrible.
And combine that with serious long-term health effects, it is a... Well, like, I really, really hope... Popham is okay, because it's an awful position. You take it to hospital.
You can buy them all. Like, was somebody, was relied on, was needed, all of a sudden not in the game, but also with these massive severe health consequences
that make them a burden,
yeah,
rather than being the
it's horrific, but yeah, it was all their own choices, and they don't get then to weaponize that with the help of very cynical people who are looking for money and status, particularly in the case of progressive rugby, who put people forward simply for this. It's a Trojan horse to basically destroy the game. They're utilizing and, you know, trying to appropriate people's ill health in order to get their own way.
My approach would be to not to amplify anything they say.
But
if you like, there will be people listening right now that have never heard of progressive rugby because they're not on Twitter.
But they might be listening to Five Live.
Occasionally, they might pop up every now and again.
They might see Steve Thompson. When you see Steve Thompson,
they most prominently exist on Twitter, and there will be people, I guarantee, who will be listening who've never heard of them, and now have heard their name.
And what will happen, Tim?
25 times
because
in this episode,
because they get played
more than any individual rugby player you've mentioned,
yeah,
that organisation.
But because of the airtime that they get. So what you've got to remember is, rugby now is largely defined by the things which have gone wrong. So if you're going to find a rugby story on the BBC and it's going to have an actual interview and get on the news, chances are you're going to be seeing Steve Thompson.
Be the change. We've got,
well, no,
we've
because
got
they're
podcast,
not going to get me.
No, we've got a podcast here with an audience. We don't need to go worry about the BBC. We don't need to worry about Twitter. We can just like tell the amazing stories about rugby and ignore.
But
this is
in a way an amazing story. It's the appropriation of our game. You know, our game is changing before our very eyes because of these people. You know, and if you deny that, like I like to say, you can deny reality, but you can't deny the consequences of denying reality.
I think there's a lot of reasons for it, and I think all we can do is put the case forward for the things and the reasons we love the game. I think it's not just an organisation like that are behind this. This is society generally. There are parents that are shit scared to let their kids.
The phone call
I took from my daughter earlier,
yeah,
was her just saying, "Can she get a lift?" She's at the park with her mates, and there's some parents who would, at whatever time it was, 9:30, some parents would be like, a 14-year-old kid with their mates at the park, what are you letting them do? And some people might judge me for that, but point being that that would, like, think back to when you were 14, that would just fucking standard.
It would just be the norm, yeah.
Would be the norm. So what I'm saying is people's relationship with risk just generally has changed, and rugby is part of that. And
you make a strong point.
It's maybe an inevitable waters that we were going to go through, irrespective of what the name or the face of that looks like.
Yeah. There was two other little tidbits this week which have really put my interest. One was an email which went to school parents. Did you guys see this? Is it an email to school parents, like, about the rugby team, and it's like an opt-out and all the risks involved in rugby. It's like, just don't tell them. Just go and play the game. If you want to play the game, if you think as an educator that this game is valuable, go play that game. Right? Done. Do not be going to a parent. It's like, it's like saying, would you like a steak? By the way, there is a 0.2% chance of you getting, you know, CJD. Like, you just don't need to know that, do you? Just, you know, it's safe, fine. And the other one was from a website of a rugby club in the Midlands. Did you read that one? Our number one priority is the health of... I'll read it. This is absolutely phenomenal. This is exactly the club
this is a rugby club. So
this is an actual rugby club, right?
So this is my point. I think it's a broader thing. This is people's relationship with risk, and I think we can just advocate that the benefits outweigh any perceived negatives.
Yeah.
Oh my word! Would you ever want to play for this club? It's absolutely astounding. This is.
We are
a tight knit community that value our players' safety and well being above all else, above lineouts. Above rocks. I mean, you're a fucking rugby club. What do you want me to tell you? Like, hi, I'm here to play rugby, bottom of my boots. How's your well-being and safety? Fuck off, pal. Like, that is exactly what you tell those people. Get out of my life. Like, I don't need you to look after my safety and well-being. Tight-knit community. It's like bullshit bingo. Like, this is the problem.
They're talking to the parents who, like I say, would judge me and think it's completely irresponsible that I let a 14-year-old be at the park with her friends at 9:15 at night.
Yeah. That is pretty irresponsible, too.
That's the people. Well, I mean, that's the judgment I mean. Like, again...
What side?
I've left my kids overnight on their own before.
Yeah.
15 and...
I'm all for it.
15 and 14. But there are 15-year-old kids that I would never leave on their own.
Yeah.
My 15-year-old son, I'm, like, totally fine with it. But some people would judge me for that. But that's my assessment of risk and...
Completely agree. Completely agree. No, that is for the men's team, by the way. That is on the men's section. Oh, imagine showing up to that. Nope, not for me, thanks.
Well, let's just, like you say, let's get stuck into the World Cup and lots of massive men smashing into each other.
Oh, no. During the World Cup, we're going to have two podcasts. You can have your fun with your... In fact, you're in France, I'll do what I want. And then I will talk about Bowden's inevitable victory against Anselmians.
Yeah, definitely. That's good. Well, no, we can definitely tick all boxes and cover all bases. Yeah, but that's it. But I love you talking about Bowden and Anselmians. Yeah.
You don't. I'm joking.
I totally do. All I was suggesting today is we put the international rugby first.
When the World Cup happens, right, we'll talk about that. But right now, real rugby is happening on real pitches in the northwest.
Oh, I love it. You're a massive advocate for the sport. Don't confuse anything I'm saying. I bloody love it. I love the passion.
Let's burn it down and rebuild it.
That's what this podcast is about.
That's what we need to do. Right. Well,
I think retreating back to your local club and building something up that's special.
Here is a genuine rugby question for you, right? So I put out to my CrossFit community, our tight-knit CrossFit community, where health and safety and our welfare is of highest order. I've offered them the chance to watch rugby with yours truly. Nobody wants to watch rugby. They'll all go for a beer. They're all up for a beer, but they're not up for the rugby. Here's my question. A, how are you going to get new people to watch the game? And B, where would you like to watch the opening game of the World Cup, providing you can't go to the stadium? You're not watching at home. Where are you going to go?
Well, I'm going to be somewhere in Marseille watching it.
Yeah,
that's cool. That's a really cool
answer. I don't know where yet.
I just rock up to a random bar.
Yeah. I might walk down to... I watched the first half of the United game today at Sale Sports Club.
I did, yeah.
Which is where Manchester Spartans play out of, but it's also Sale Cricket Club and they play hockey out of there.
How would you to play at Spartans in a few weeks?
Yeah, I might, because it's 200 yards from my house, so it's a very short stroll, so I might just wander down there.
Nice.
We've got a few nice beers on tap.
Was it 8 p.m. kickoff? It's 9 p.m. French time, but 8 p.m.
Oh, perfect timing as well.
Yeah.
Perfect timing.
ITV prime time, 8 p.m. Yeah.
Yeah, so I might wander down there.
There's two things. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to try and introduce a handful of people from CrossFit to Didsbury Rugby Club to watch to watch the game. That is my plan. Also, funny you mentioned Spartans. I'm also due to play for them or try to play for them in about 3 weeks' time. Because I trained with two gay chaps who are semi-interested in rugby but not entirely sure. I said, well, come down and I'll play the first game with you.
Is that going to be Clarendon Crescent?
It will be there, yeah. Presumably. Yeah. So we've emailed them.
The Red Wreck.
To see if they'll have us, and they will. And we just need to organise the actual date.
Awesome. So. Yeah, when you get a date, I'll...
Love it.
I suppose I can walk 200 metres to watch you play rugby.
I've guaranteed them I'll score at least 4 tries.
There was a message that went out on just a little WhatsApp group I'm on going, can any lads turn out for the threes? We're a bit short. And I was, there was, for a moment, I went, I could,
you could do it.
I could, I just, no.
Might knock your CrossFit back for a few weeks.
Exactly, that's the fear. If we get injured,
do you know what? I am genuinely injured. I'd never get injured, but I'm actually worried about picking up an injury now.
For CrossFit,
yeah.
Well, my ankle from the Christmas game last year is still not. I can run, but it is imperfect.
I'm on the verge of surpassing my 130 clean now. I mean, I'm that close, and the idea of getting injured so close to the competition as well.
That's the other thing of travelling around France. I've got my grips.
Have you?
I've got my skipping rope already packed, so I'll be doing some CrossFit.
There'll be lots of places. Nice. On the continent, there's loads of places.
Really. I'd just love go to and do some chin-ups. Marseille on Friday, you know.
Go for a jog, do some chin-ups, do some box, like jump onto a wall. Like you can do loads of stuff with very little equipment.
Yeah, you can.
You have a really good workout.
You've got a 24-kilogram baggage allowance. Have you to go over to...
Just carry kettlebell over. Yeah, that's all you need. Right, if we're talking about all this, we better get off.
Yes.
Yep.
Nice one. So. Let the boys play.
Thanks, boys.
normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.